Three, two, done.
Oh, you did it on, you're supposed to.
You know, you don't say one. I point, you point on one. You don't say one. Have you never worked in live broadcasting, Joe?
I can't see you pointing.
Well,
because this is an audio medium, not a visual.
I'm pretty sure you can like count beats though. You know what comes after two, right?
Zero.
Yeah, zero.
Exactly. so,
not only can you not see me pointing, you would be super embarrassed if you saw me pointing.
Yeah. Well, yes, that is actually accurate because you do that with water bottles, but I've seen you do that in person. But we're not talking about us because today we are talking about Todd Fazeri.
Who, oh, really?
Yay!
Who is on our podcast. Yay!
It's a good thing I'm here.
Well, we were going to talk about you behind your back, but then
what
we decided.
The odds?
Oh, cheers. It's more fun to do it directly to your face. No, yeah. Just kidding.
I'm ready.
Okay. So, what's your defense for lens flares? Starting now.
Is that how you're going to come at them right out of the gate?
No, it's not a real thing. I'm just kidding.
You know, the build up to the Force Awakens opening and having been on all these JJ shows and having been, you know, partially responsible for this whole lens flare in modern film stuff, it's like any JJ announcement, any JJ press release, any interview, and then the internet folks are like, lens flare, there's gonna be lens flares. I don't, what was the consensus? Were there too many lens flares in The Force Awakens? Were there not enough lens flares in The Force Awakens? Because I heard them both. I heard there were just the right amount for an anamorphic picture. What did you guys think?
Yes.
Okay.
That's gonna be none of them stuck out in my memory, so I say just the right amount.
Yes. I was kidding when I was giving you my paper or plastic yes answer, but I like The Force Awakens. I feel like that is striking the perfect balance. They were very artfully used. I did perceive some of them, but there were very many subtle ones, which, you know, is nice because it's always just fun to find those
since
later.
You started like this presence. What were the ones that were the most omnipresent? What were the ones that hit you the hardest where you're like, oh, this is a JJ movie?
Well, no, I didn't say that because it wasn't anything like what he did for the Star Trek ones, where it was I would say more bombastic and in your face. I would say the most prominent one is probably the big red one when they fire the weapon and Kylo Ren is up on the bridge.
Yeah.
But the other ones are like when they first do the landing at the very beginning of the movie and he's walking out of the ship and there's blasters and stuff. There's some in there. But it's not stark, I would say. It's not like hey, anamorphic flare bleeding in from the side while someone's talking. You know, that doesn't really happen. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's different. I enjoy how it was played.
That's good to know. Well, I mean, we definitely tried to strike a balance, and it was definitely not the Star Trek, you know, reboot. It was not those types of films. We were trying to work within a certain framework, but still, you know, be true to Dan Mindell and JJ's vision. But you know,
yes, I like it. I would say that it's more photographic in the new Star Wars than I felt like it was maybe in the new Star Treks. Even though you worked on both, but mm-hmm. You know, it's a stylistic choice. Mm-hmm. For, you know, the particular genre, the thing that is being told.
Now, are you allowed to say, are you guys still no light factory for all of that?
I'm not really allowed to say.
Oh, fair enough.
There's a bit of that. There's a bit of the tool that probably you're thinking of. And for, at least for me, there's a lot of home. I wrote my own kind of tool set for it.
Oh,
we use a lot of real flares that we shot, and then I build tools around that. So
you compile your lens flares from source.
Yes.
Okay.
Python or what are we working with here?
A lot of HyperCard.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I mean, you got to go with what works. And
yeah, really, HyperTalk is a very tested programming language at this point. So you want to make sure you rely on something like that.
You talk nuke on this show a lot, so I'm gonna just basically say expressions. That's my coding language is expressions, because I don't know.
So are you fluent in TCL?
Tickle, as they say, tickle.
No, that's when I ask my very intelligent fellow employees to help me out. No, I just do expressions.
Okay, but thank you for dodging artfully our questions.
Sure.
So, Todd, we didn't properly introduce you at the beginning of this episode. We relied on the assumption that everyone is amazing and would already know you. But you are a compositing supervisor and lead and digital artist, depending on what the project is, over at Industrial Light and Magic in the Grand Bay Area.
Yeah.
How would you describe that yourself?
That's a pretty good description. Yeah. Yeah. I just realized I'm about to hit my later this year my 15th year at ILM, which I guess makes me a lifer. I don't know, but
get you anything nice, like a paperweight, or what do you get? Is it like a pot set they let you like engrave? Like what do you get for 15?
For 15, you know, since the Disney has purchased Lucasfilm, there's been there's like 5-year increment of awards, and I think we get some kind of little Mickey Mouse statue or something like that. I'm not entirely sure.
One of those watches where Mickey Mouse's arms spin around.
Yeah, yeah, you get the watch face on the Apple Watch. That's exclusive, right?
Sure. Yeah, you can only turn that on after you've worked at ILM for 15 years.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, get special code. Punch in the code. No, there should be something at 15 years, I assume. I hope.
A pat on the back, say thanks for the good work and get back to work.
Good job, get back to work. We're behind.
I hope it's some Microsoft publisher 97 kind of like a print border around the edges. And
it's a HyperCard manual. It's definitely out of my flares.
So, Todd, other than, let's say, the most recent Star Trek movie, recent Star Wars movie, you've also worked on the most recent Star Trek movies. Would you characterize yourself as a Star Trek or Star Wars fan?
You know, definitely Star Wars numero uno. I mean, it was the first, you know,
what was the first movie that really made you excited about visual effects?
Well, Star Wars. Yeah, that's the answer that almost everybody in my age range gives. And that's true. I mean, it got me excited about movies. And Star Trek came later for me. In fact, Star Trek II was really my real introduction to Star Trek. I was never a big fan of the old show that was playing on reruns when I was a kid. So I don't think I ever watched an entire episode all the way through, and there was something about the colors, and it was just so super bright and saturated and stiff, and I didn't like that when they walked down the hallways that you could see underneath the sets. Like, and there was something that rubbed me the wrong way. You know, there's certain shows, like, I get this a lot from my generation, like, you know, the show MASH, that rubbed a lot of people the wrong way, and they never would watch it, and I would really try to pound down why people would just avoid it like the plague. And it turned out it was like, for a lot of people, it's the color palette. You know, everything was just gray, olive, drab. The bizarre laugh track of an audience that isn't there threw people off. But you know, if the same kind, I can't really explain what. You know, why I didn't really fall in love with Star Trek. I think everything was, you know, all the stars were aligned. I should have liked Star Trek, the show, but I never really got into it. And Star Trek II was the first real experience I had with Star Trek, and I really loved it as a kid. I was actually exactly 8 years old, I think, which is exactly the year, the age of my daughter right now. And I just showed it to her for the first time 2 weeks ago. So.
Did you see it in theaters, or when did you see it? When was your
I'm
first
pretty
exposure?
Sure I saw it in a theater. We in our hometown, we had a second run, you know, like a dollar theater. And we would just basically anything that was rated PG, once I hit like 6 or 7 years old, we would go see. I'm pretty sure I saw this in the theater. And I think my parents got a little freaked out with, especially with the the things burrowing into the ears, the eels. other than that,
it's just models. You were fine.
I think that is probably the thing that people remember most, like the single most like nightmare inducing, like that pierces people's psyches about this film. You know, like it's the most gentle, like David Cronenberg esque, you know, body mutilation thing in the you know, in science fiction. It's so mild compared to all that other stuff, but it's just enough to it still drives people nuts just thinking about it.
Dan, did it drive you nuts? You saw it for the first time tonight.
The 5 foot long wooden ear that the thing crawled into.
Oh God, Joe.
So as you can see, Dan is unfazed.
You know, it was slightly horrifying. It was done, you know, with enough drama to be effective. But just looking at it, it didn't look like an ear.
Is it the overscaled ear? Is that what's bothering you? Is that, or what about the other shots and how it was developed and how the scenes progressed? That stuff didn't really get you.
When they were crawling on the bowl, when he fished him out of the back of the other thing.
No, it was totally terrifying, especially, you know, when he's poking at the thing and he pulls him out of the back. It's all very gross and kind of gruesome and it makes you cringe a little bit when he's getting ready to do it, even though, you know, he's just about to set it down on a big wooden ear. But it was nicely done. There was good suspense to it. And of course, Ricardo sells everything. So, you know, it worked, but it's a big wooden ear. I don't know what else to say.
You know, the oversized ear, you know, I'm sure we're going to get into all this, but the oversized ear is probably one of the things that were, you know, the ear itself, the is one of the things that holds up the least in the film in terms of effects.
Is that hanging up on a wall somewhere, by the way?
You know, I haven't seen it. I think if it was made out of foam, it probably has been, you know, withered away and been destroyed by now. But I have not seen it anywhere at ILM. I should really ask around about that. I'll get back to you.
Yeah, I saw a photo, I think, from when they were actually shooting the stuff, and they had somebody had made like a giant cotton swab to pose next to the ear for a photo.
Yep.
So that was humorous. I like that.
And the way they actually set up that shot with like weird like crash zoom, that animated zoom from a wide shot of Chekhov profile laying down, and then you're just kind of zoom in there. It doesn't exactly help the effect. It would have been better just as a cut.
I think there's the two times that you see it. There's the first time when they're burrowing in, and then there's that second time when it crawls out of Chekhov's ear. You know, so you got to get your money's worth out of your giant wooden ear, apparently. But it's interesting because I don't know if we would necessarily bother to do something like that these days, like with little tiny things crawling inside of people's brains. I think you would see like a swarm of little particle things crawl inside of somebody's ear. You wouldn't see like a little puppet thing on top of a surface moving inside. Like, mm-hmm. Even if it had been perfectly replaced with something that looked like the footage of the side of Walter Koenig's head, or mm-hmm. you know, but it's interesting, and I think it's definitely of its time. It was it was the style at the time in 1982 to do these kinds of things. I would say myself, so I can enjoy it in the context of that, regardless of its cheese factor.
Dan, this is the first time you've ever seen the movie.
I've seen bits of it before, but yes, this is the first time I've seen the whole thing, and now am aware of the overall plot of it all. I don't even know how many times the whole Genesis thing has come up in the context of discussing, you know, the effects that were used to create that animation. Mm-hmm. I think it's been, you know, half dozen at least. But yeah, I haven't seen the whole movie, and of course there's GIFs galore all over the internet, including the one that you tweeted earlier today that I've seen for sure. But one of the first things I sent to Joe in the Slack when I started watching it is the new Star Trek movies really kind of screwed up the beginning of this movie for me, because it's like that thing I've seen, but different and backwards, and the people are in the wrong places.
Well, like,
defend the movies, Todd. You worked on them.
Maybe we
He's just angry at you for saying you like Star Wars more than Star Trek. He's going to fight you after the show.
Let me finish up that Star Trek conversation.
Okay.
Because I did very much get into Star Trek Next Generation. I was a big, big fan of that. And I think in terms of the series, Next Generation is definitely my favorite. I appreciated some of the big story arcs and drama that was in Deep Space Nine and how, you know, it took a couple of years for them to get their footing, but I really ended up liking a lot of that drama. There was Voyager, which I really liked. Was that Tuvok and Neelix? Yeah.
Yes, but not, you didn't like them when they were crossed together as two.
No,
did you?
No. Okay. But when they were apart and yelling at each other, that was my favorite part of that show.
I just wanted to make sure.
Then then there was that Enterprise thing. No. Then I really liked the Even movies, as everybody does, you know, 2, 4, 6, and 8, right? And then the dark time, and there was like nothing for the longest time, right? And then I worked on the Trek reboot and then the Trek sequel. So, and those two completely live within the context of the original series and the original movie. You can't, I think the goal of 2009 Star Trek was to open up Star Trek to, even people who had never seen it before, but especially Into Darkness. You know, I don't know. I think it lives within a context and it does not live on its own like any remake or reboot or sequel. It requires a certain amount of knowledge. And then from your perspective, Dan, you've seen the Star Trek and Star Trek Into Darkness before even Wrath of Khan, right?
Yeah, I've seen both of those a couple times. And then I saw Star Trek 4 because we did it on the show. And then what did I watch, Joe? I watched an Enterprise episode.
Yeah. Well,
that's all. This is called the Machete Order, I guess.
Exactly. This is the appropriate way to watch the Star Trek movies and series.
It's the first way. And now you should watch the series, the original series. And I don't know. Your brain must be just like, what is wrong? Why do people like this stuff? I don't know.
These names and sort of the characters are vaguely familiar, but I have no idea what's going on in this world. I kind of assemble some of it from the things Joe tells me that I sort of understand partially.
I feel like the beginning of Star Trek II does a pretty decent job of setting up what your expectations of this world might be. Like, here's an admiral. He is in charge of, you know, training these cadets. He is worried about how old he's getting and about how he doesn't have the command of his ship anymore. We find out about his old missions and the consequences of them via somebody he sent to a planet to live on. You get just enough information that you don't necessarily need to have seen Space Seed or the original series or have watched Star Trek, the motion picture. At least I don't feel like that is a requirement.
And that's exactly where I came from. I didn't know Space Seed and I had not seen the motion picture. I was completely, you know, this was a new thing to me.
Yeah. And I saw them all out of order as a kid because I was a little younger than Todd. And I saw Star Trek 4 is the first one that I have a recollection of seeing. Star Trek 6 is the first one I think I saw in theaters. Star Trek 5, I think I saw on like cable, or we rented it from Blockbuster or something like that. Star Trek the Motion Picture, we also rented from Blockbuster. And Star Trek 2, I watched like almost a decade later, I would say, on like TBS or something in the middle of the night. Back when they used to just like play random stuff. And so that was how I came to see Star Trek 2 for the first time, as well as Star Trek 3. And it's interesting because you can, even though they're all intertwined, and I think you get a greater appreciation from seeing them in probably the correct order, I don't feel like you are necessarily like lost in a drift completely if you sat down and watched any particular one of them, because Harv Bennett, who was a producer, seems to have gone through and put a sort of like TV production stamp on these films, where at the beginning of the film, you get like sort of a preparation of like, this is what you need to know, like either in the form of a literal recap of the previous one, or in like in terms of exposition of what you need to know with the about where the characters are in the
I'm glad you brought that up, because I was going to say part of this did feel like sort of a larger extended television episode, and I thought you were going to get mad at me for saying that, but it's good to hear that you said that it, it was kind of intended to be that way.
And again, in talking about, like, I love talking about franchises, and I adore talking about how they've changed and how they evolve, and but, you know, like for the Star Trek movies, like 2, 3, and 4 ultimately are, you know, one narrative thread, and that was never intended. Within the context of Star Trek II, I mean, you're talking about, you know, it feels like a contained episode. I mean, that was entirely intentional when, you know, because within the context of the Star Trek the motion picture, it was a big hit, but it was it cost a lot of money. And Paramount did not want to repeat that. They wanted to make a sequel, but they did not want to repeat like this multi-year, I think, what was the budget? Like $35, $40 million or something, which was, you know, massive amount at the time.
I thought they hit like 60 or something. Like it was absurd the amount of money that they spent on it for the time completely.
And it was a big hit, but then they said, okay, we're definitely going to make another one, but we are not going to let this happen again. And that's, if I got my history right, I think that's when Bennett was brought on and Roddenberry was asked to, you know, not participate in Star Trek II. And it was very much run like a TV show. And I think it was actually maybe even run under the auspices of Paramount Television. With a fraction of the budget. I think it was like a third or a quarter of the budget of the predecessor, which is crazy.
Yeah, I think that Harv Bennett was a TV producer, and Gene Roddenberry was a TV producer, but Gene Roddenberry had like these, well, let's just say he was a little overambitious, thought that maybe he was making like 2001 A Space Odyssey, and maybe like people didn't want to see that. There was a lot of like loopiness going on there, much in the same way that people criticize the way Lucas approached the prequels, I would say, he didn't necessarily connect with the fans in the same way, that the fans might have appreciated. So Harv Bennett comes in, he's a TV producer, and he understands TV budgets, and he understands reusing sets, he understands scrimping and saving and all this stuff. I believe Todd is correct that this was done as potentially, it was might have been like a TV movie at some point, but it was elevated to the point of it being a feature film, fortunately.
Have I mentioned if I like the movie or not, Star Trek II? Have I mentioned that yet?
I just inferred that you liked it because I told you we were doing this and you wanted to be on the show. Yeah. But
I love this movie.
Okay,
I love it. I loved it when I was a kid, and I did not watch it for probably a decade, and then I've watched it now like every few years, and it still gets to me. And then there was another long stretch of not watching it, and then I watched it in preparation for showing it to my kid, and I still like it. I think it holds up really well.
I'm not sure it holds up for modern adult audiences.
The drama. Maybe not the and I'll get into that when we go into, if we go through the movie, you know, there's definitely, you know, cutting corners when it comes to aesthetics and gloss and fit and finish. I mean, it has the, you know, the feeling of a really good TV production. So it does not hold, I mean, this is the same year as Blade Runner, right? 82? So, you know, if that's its, you know, cohort in science fiction, there's kind of, you know, there's not a lot of competition there in terms of gloss and design, just beautiful, straight up design stuff. But the drama, if I can use that term,
you can't, but go ahead.
I will. Damn it. I will. It hits me every time. The efficiency of the screenplay. the proper use of an ensemble. You know, it's always hard to make movies out of TV shows because you usually have a big cast and to service and make sure that everybody has something to do. They threw that away in this one. It's like, this is about Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, and everybody else has a supporting role, and a good supporting role, but a supporting role. I think it hits all those marks really well. It has really good forward momentum, a crazy villain. I don't know. I loved it.
Dan, counterpoint?
You just keep trying to throw me under the bus here, don't you?
I love buses. Public transportation should be supported.
Yeah, those don't run out where I live. So it's got 1982-ness all over it. And what good old Ricardo is doing there is certainly... it's over the top in the way that only a character in a movie like this could be. Like this couldn't have been contained in a TV movie. It's too big for that. But you know,
he was doing Fantasy Island at the time, Dan.
Yes. And trying to evaluate how it's aged is very difficult because I wasn't watching this kind of stuff back then. But it's certainly the case that there is a lot more pensive sitting and staring in this one than there are in the newer Star Treks. But I guess it's good to see, you know, where the characters and the things came from.
You guess?
I'm glad I have seen it and have it to compare against the reboots and remakes and stuff. But so I won't say I didn't like the movie, but I will say that
it's not the kind of thing that I'm going to watch regularly because
I'm just not really that much of Star Trek kind of guy.
Dan, if you're going to cut me deep, come on.
Shatner,
go for the gold.
Shatner is terrible at pretending to fight.
Yes.
As I mentioned to you in the Slack, like, oh, look at me, I'm so old and I have to wear glasses now. And this is two of how many movies? How long did they keep going after this?
He himself was in seven of these.
Okay. All right. So there's that.
But there were six with the original complete cast. It was it was Star Trek Generations, though, that he, Chekhov, and Scotty reappeared. And then Kirk stuck around for the movie. I don't recommend Star Trek Generations.
The only other initial thing I was going to say is I think the opening credits sequence for this movie is longer than the movie we watched last week.
Dan, it was a different time where you had, like, credits and an overture.
Stars and text and James Horner, yes.
What short film did you watch last week?
We watched Torque last week, and I think the credits for Torque were exactly as long, but there was more of it that was moving around the screen, so that might have entertained.
And it was a 1 hour 24-minute runtime.
That might have entertained Dan's little lizard brain more than stars and some text.
It entertained my ear slug brain more so than something like
that. Dan needs that MTV style cutting. Cut. Give me something.
I am a digital boy living in a digital world, or whatever the hell the saying is.
I have some notes in my here about like super long takes in Star Trek 2, so we'll get to those. Where I'm just assuming you were falling asleep.
I was probably just writing notes.
I'm assuming that he was just like reading his Twitter feed, but so let's get into the film now, shall we? The movie starts off with some dramatic little intonations, some little musical numbers from Mr. James Horner. This is his first big break after having done Battle of the Planets? Is that the one?
No, I'm not sure.
Anyway,
I mean, definitely his first big break. And this is coming off of Jerry Goldsmith, who is, you know, one of the masters of the, and a beautiful score for that motion picture. But they
could not afford him.
They couldn't. Yeah, definitely. If anybody's really interested in this movie and how this movie was made, the Nicholas Meyer, the director, the writer director of the movie, wrote a really fun memoir called "Views from the Bridge" or "My View from the Bridge," and he talks a lot about Star Trek too, and he goes into crazy detail about the making of this film. And I think he mentioned, yeah, Goldsmith was completely out of the picture because of his salary, and they got this kid named James Horner. And come on, this score is really, really awesome. I mean, the old joke about James Horner is that he did the same score, for the rest of his career. But this score is incredible. It's bombastic. It sounds nothing like anything else at the time. I don't know. If Dan was falling asleep at this opening title sequence, the music had to have been like.
No, let me defend myself a little bit. There were times in this movie where as someone who doesn't typically notice scores, I did actually notice the score from time to time, and it was adding a lot of drama and intensity to some of these scenes, and I really appreciated that.
Yeah, well, and also you probably were like, hey, this reminds me of Aliens, but so
exactly.
James Horner, his stamp on this movie is huge because there is music out the wazoo, and I love all of it. I own this. I listen to it sometimes. I listen to it on the drive to record this podcast tonight because it is so interesting. Surprise Attack is one of my favorite little tracks off of the soundtrack album. That just wakes you right up. And fills you full of adrenaline because, oh my god, somebody's going to kill me. But in Battle of Mutara Nebula, it's like, I can do this. I can beat this traffic. That's a good one to drive to.
Did you think in a Z-axis?
No, Dan. I thought in X, Y, and Z-axis because I have three-dimensional thinking.
Do you have a three-dimensional car, though, that can move in all of those directions?
No, of course not, because I live on Earth.
It's a shame.
I only think in outer space. But so the thing is that he has such an amazing imprint on this film, but he, like Todd said, went on to go to many similar sounding things later on in his career. So maybe perhaps when you were very interested in taking note of the score, you might have been like, oh, hey, that's like that other movie that I've seen. I don't know if that had occurred to you as well. No. as you watched it. But once we move past the opening overture,
I pulled up my iTunes and tried to find the play count for Surprise Attack on iTunes, and I have 182 plays on that one. So, yeah, we play that a lot around the house.
That's impressive.
It's good for kids, I guess.
Yeah. the kids love it. They love it. Before, I mean, my daughter knew that track really well before we saw the movie, and she would always ask, "What's happening now? What's happening now? What's happening now?"
Is that for like tag or like hide and go seek?
No, we just listen to music.
Oh,
you're all just chilling out. There are kids around the beanbag.
Yeah,
you're listening to Surprise Attack.
Exactly.
Okay.
Turn on the disco ball and the glowy lights, and just stare up at the ceiling.
And the infinity mirror thing, but so yes. Anyway, the beginning of the movie, we come in on the bridge, and surprise, it is not anyone we know. It is Kirstie Alley, and she's running the show. She is in the captain's chair. Spock is over at the science station, and Sulu's, doing his Sulu stuff, and we have Dr. McCoy, we have Uhura. Everyone is manning their stations and doing their stuff, and there is a distress call that has come in. And we quickly go find out what this distress call is about with some CAD software. And so we see the little bubble thing, and then it expands, and it's like, oh, it's in the neutral zone. Oh, crap. And then we
go... It's
pretty
small neutral zone, by the way. Or was that just the limitations of the CAD software?
CAD software? Maybe the simulation thinks that they have a smaller treaty area. I have no idea what the parameters of the Kobayashi Maru test are.
It could
are.
Fit like five ships in that neutral zone.
it certainly didn't seem like it was a big hazard, I would say. But, you know, maybe it was forced perspective. But they go into...
I don't think that's how that works.
It's all about the lens.
So you don't want to put a wide-angle lens on your CAD software. So they go into
They accidentally mix it up with that lens that they used at the end when they were spinning around and all the stars were flying around in the wide-angle lens.
Yeah.
Dan is full of spite. So we go into the...
I have so few observations. I have to make them when I can.
Okay. Spiteful observations. But we go into the little bubble, and there's an alert and stuff, and the distress signal appears to be either false or jammed, and they're the Klingon ships, and oh crap, what do we do? And it's like, well, let's maybe get out of here, but kind of, sort of, and then stuff explodes, and people are falling over dead, and Spock falls over dead, and that was a big deal, because the rumor about Spock dying had gotten out before the film had come out and when it was still in development, and so they kind of wrote in this little scene here, so he'd be dead at the beginning of the movie.
I think that's such incredible genius that it even in the pre-internet days of then, when, oh, there's whispers that Spock's going to die in the next movie, that they were like, oh yeah, you think we're going to kill him off? So they wrote this in there to completely diffuse the situation. Like, they're trolling the audience, saying, oh, this is what you heard, right? And then, you know, oh, tension released. And then later in the movie, when it actually happens, it's like that much more of an impact. I think that's awesome. I thought that was an absolutely brilliant move to completely, oh, you think he's going to die? Boom, first scene, he's dead. Eh, just kidding. I think that's really cool.
Yeah, I think it was very effective, because then you'd be like, nope. We were totally faked out by this because of the simulation. And it totally won't happen in the course of the film. Unfortunately, Dan has life experience that extends several years beyond what most people could expect. So he probably foresaw that Spock was probably going to die at the end of the film. But and having seen 4, where he talks about being dead, Dan might also have intuited that he died. So Dan... was this a total shocker for you?
The only thing that made my head tilt to the side was the extent of the simulation that generated explosions coming out of the consoles, and everyone really selling their flying and flopping onto the ground. I guess that adds some realism to the simulation for the captain to watch the people around them dying. Because no win situation and whatnot, but...
it's a test of character, Dan.
It's a test of character to see if you can keep a straight face while all these people are flopping around on the ground pretending to die.
But at no point in this film...
You are correct. No, I did not think that they were dying then, and I did know that we were in for the thing later.
Okay. Because it had been ruined for you by Todd working JJ movies.
That other movie ruined it.
Yeah, it's really Todd's fault. So...
I just wonder what order you read the Harry Potter books. Is it like 5, 2, then 7?
Dan, have you even seen any of the Harry Potter movies?
I think that's what you should do. Harry Potter 5, 2, 7, 3, 4, 1. Yeah, I think that's how you should do it.
See, that's actually my checking account number, so that's how I choose things. You will be shocked to learn that I have neither read or seen any Harry Potter anythings.
That's actually Dan's prefix code. So
yes,
let's move on.
That's my master password.
We'll get to that.
The screen opens up as if it were a door, and it is. And light comes streaming in, which seems ill-advised. And then Kirk walks in, and he's all like, "Yeah, you guys all blew up and died. Good job, A+, everyone." And He you know, gives it to Savick for that, and you know, it's like the Kobayashi Maru test, like it's the no-win scenario. You know, that's a situation that any captain might come across, and you know, that's a nice way of saying it when you know that you yourself have cheated on the test in your life. But
yeah, he's awfully smug in the scene, isn't he? He's like, oh yeah, you hit the one of the two outcomes. Whatever. Yeah.
The smugness of Kirk is off the scale in this film.
I want to make quick mention of the shot of him entering you know, the view screen moving away and the God rays and everything. So two things. One, I've definitely used that that God rays shot as a reference for God rays and other shows in my time, because it's a really beautiful shot, especially in contrast to what everything has been going on so far. And two, I learned that was a reshoot, because I guess maybe he entered as originally shot, just like through a turbo lift or whatever, and just kind of came in and goes, "Hey, I'm Admiral Kirk." But they needed in the final edit, and when they were editing the picture, they were like, "Oh, we need a much more dramatic entrance for." And I think that was a studio note. We need a much more dramatic entrance for Kirk, and I think this fits the bill. It's pretty dramatic.
Yeah, and I think just having him walk in off the side, it wouldn't necessarily feel as satisfying that this was a simulator room. Like, having the whole front of it peel off, and it's just totally not what you would expect from the Enterprise bridge, then that very firmly establishes that it's something else. So I do agree that gives him a nice entrance.
When we're talking about the comparison between this movie and the newer movies with the Kobayashi Maru, it wasn't the most subtle thing in the world in this particular movie, the way they kept bringing up the no-win scenario, and I have questions about it throughout the movie. But I did think they paid it off. It's, you know, it's a little cheesy again, but they paid it off a lot better in this movie than I thought they did in the reboots, because it actually does come back in a meaningful way at the end of the movie.
I think that's partly because in the new movie that you kind of have to appreciate this in the old movie for that payoff in the first Star Trek 2009 film. I think that there are other references to Star Trek 2 that get made in the second film that how should I put this? Can kind of stand on their own and perhaps supersede the original in someone's mind if they see that film first and then go back and watch this and it seems different. Like, that might seem like the correct thing to them in their brains, but I don't agree with that because I saw this film first. But that's something. I just, you know, in terms of like Kobayashi Maru in the first Star Trek film in 2009, it certainly felt like more of a wink and a nod to the nerds than it felt like it was something that really helped the audience in general.
Right, but I mean, it is that secondary that could be the payoff plot element is used in the, you know, Into Darkness, but it's paid off in the original here, obviously, because it's set up in the same movie, and I think it works nicely.
Yeah. Because the two are really intertwined here, whereas in the JJ movies, it's split into his academy year where he did the thing, which is only alluded to in dialogue, and then his actual attempt at executing the no-win scenario in the second one with the reactor, etc., where that's flipped on its head from what it is in this film. But it stands in isolation from the Kobayashi Maru talk that's been going on the whole time through this film. So it's weird that way, because it doesn't have the same payoff that this film does, where it's all like sort of self-contained. I feel like. What do you think, Todd?
You know, the thing about and this is why I'm a terrible guest, is that the 2009 Star Trek and Star Trek Into Darkness, I'm still so close to those movies that it's really hard for me to, I haven't yet hit that perspective point where I can actually look back on those movies with, you know, with a certain amount of objectivity, because the battles are still too fresh for me, you know, like, and you know, I remember that day when I pulled up the sequence of the Kobayashi Maru for Into Darkness. I'm like, oh wow, they're gonna make reference to this, and oh, they're doing this. So all of that stuff is still like, you know, like listening to the press about Cumberbatch is playing John Harrison. You know, that whole like internal fight of preserving who he's. Cumberbatch was actually playing is I'm still kind of like in, you know, secret mode about that. So in the context of I just the Into Darkness and Star Trek 2009, they're just different entities, and it's a different chapter entirely. It's so hard, just for me personally, to talk about those in the context of this movie, which is, you know, what, 36 years old, whatever, how old this is. Obviously, the writers of Star Trek and Into Darkness had a great reverence for Wrath of Khan. And they wanted to, you know, allude to it and riff off of it and mirror it as much as they could. Sometimes to a, you know, giggly extent when a different character yells Khan's name out in anger is, you know, some people thought that was a yeah moment and others thought it was, you know, time to giggle. You know, a ham-fisted homage, you know, and God, you know, God bless them all. But I personally can't make heads or tails of it. The scars are still too fresh.
Todd, it's okay. We're not asking you to throw yourself or your employer under the bus.
They're still
you're
both
fine.
Fun, beautiful movies, and we don't expect you to be able to look at them.
I liked them both. I thought they were both really good.
I am jokingly asking you to defend yourself, literally asking you to defend yourself.
I tell you, man, he's trying to slowly get back at you for saying Star Wars instead of Star Trek. He's going to fight you.
No, Dan, you're just trying to distract me from the fact that I don't like you at all because you don't like this movie. No, but
it's not that I don't like the movie. It's this. Never mind.
Uh huh. Go on.
Star Trek is not my thing. It is your thing.
Well, thank you for letting me have my thing. So we go on from this to them walking through the hallway and talking about the test and how it always wreaks havoc on stuff, so it's not that big of a deal. And then Spock offers Kirk a birthday present, surely the best of times. And it is Tale of Two Cities. And you know, any conscious reference? Nope, none that I'm aware of. It's just your birthday, so yay.
When they walk past the Starfleet custodian.
And he looks backwards at the guy vacuuming.
I love how Shatner just looks back at him. He's like, what on earth is that contraption? It's like method, you know, Shatner. Like, I think Shatner gives a pretty good performance in this for Shatner, you know, a Shatner-esque performance. But, there's those little touches, I think, add a lot of, like, detail to this movie where he he really looks at that guy.
It's like in the director commentary from the director's cut of Star Trek II, Nicholas Meyer didn't want him to look at the guy, and it was just like, oh, fine, whatever. Like that's our take. We gotta move on. But he's like, he still regrets that. Like that still bothers him that he looked back at it. Like it was something weird that the guy was doing, and it should have just been like a normal custodian work, but. I'm not fazed by it so much, so I could read it either way. Like,
I think it's a cool detail.
Yeah.
And another cool detail is that wide shot with the Spock and Kirk talking in that hallway.
Perspective of the
That's really beautiful stuff. That globe and the ferns and everything in the foreground to make the set to make the Starfleet headquarters look even more grand than what they could build. That was actually a tiny little model in front of the camera. And shot in live in camera through that tiny little model to make it look like a beautiful set piece. And hey, that stuff works.
Did you notice that when you're watching it, Dan?
You know, I did, because practical effects are really they're something that I have a passion
you
for.
Did, you
and
didn't.
Stick
you
out.
Did,
no,
you
I have
didn't.
No idea. What are you talking no. about?
Well, practical effects are always better.
Yeah, of course. It's the sign of a true filmmaker.
At the beginning of this film, there is that wide shot, like Todd was just saying. And there's that globe thing that's in the foreground, but that's not really like in the foreground that you might think it is. It is in the extreme foreground because it is next to the camera because it is a tiny little model, just like Todd said. It is quite impressive. They did a lot of work basically for one shot, just so that they could build out this set that they couldn't afford to build in person.
And I love that. I love that kind of scrappy, you know, this is a TV, this is an elevated TV movie as we talked about it. And those kind of flourishes, you know, the efficiency of building which sets for which scenes, and we'll get into that. I love that stuff.
Yeah. And honestly, that is not even the kind of thing that you would expect a television show to do, is to build that sort of level of detail, especially just for one singular shot. And that's the only time it's used. Like, it's not like revisited or recycled or anything. So it's an interesting little thing. But they have their little conversation. Spock's got to go back to his thing, and Kirk's got to go back to his gaudy apartment. And Kirk goes to his awful apartment, and in there are, like, what is it, TRS-80-somethings and like, guns on the wall.
Lots of guns.
It is an absurd...
A disturbing number of guns.
It is an absurd room. I don't understand his... Like, what he was thinking when he collected these things, I have no idea. But they're all on display there. It's just like, here are six, like, blunderbusses and and some old computers. A terrible scene of San Francisco Bay. So,
but you know, there's a nice little touch that I don't think I ever noticed as a kid, that foghorn going off. I like that. I thought that was a nice little detail.
Well, that's how you know you're in San Francisco.
Yeah.
And then McCoy walks in with a bread bowl. No, I'm just kidding. It's a Romulan ale. And he offers it.
He basically comes in with weed. I mean, right? I mean,
they seem to play it in the manner that I've seen that depicted in other films. I have no experience with the product that you refer to, but yes, he walks in and he's like, "Beware, Romulans bearing strange gifts," and he hands him the little baggie with the stuff, and then it's like, "Oh, Romulan ale, you know that's illegal.
Only use it for medicinal purposes."
Yeah. That's what everybody says. Medicinal purposes. Isn't that right, Dan?
That glaucoma.
In 1982, wouldn't that be more of like an LSD kind of thing?
No, see, Spock did a little too much LDS back when he was at Berkeley.
Of course.
That was a reference, Dan.
To that other movie we watched. Yeah, I remember.
Yeah. So, anyway, they chit-chat.
I'm still here and awake and thinking.
I just want to make sure you're alive. So they have a little chit chat, and you know why are we treating yours like a funeral? Why are you treating your birthday like a funeral? Like, here are your glasses. You're allergic to our Retinox. LASIK has gone out of style or something. But we're not going to trouble ourselves with things that haven't been invented yet. But so they have their conversation about mortality, where he's worried about himself and his legacy and what he does. In his own vitality as a human being and feeling like he is a part of the universe. And McCoy has some nice little pithy lines about, you know, get your command back before you are part of your collection here. Your blunderbusses and your old computers. You know, so did any of that affect you, Dan?
Sure.
Okay, you've answered the question. Moving on.
Wake up, Dan.
Todd, did any of that affect you?
As a pre-old guy, I think this, you know, when I was a kid, I was like, oh, this is old people problems. But now that I'm a pre-old man, I don't know. This stuff really rings true. I think if you were really good at something and then, I don't know, I'm personally really sensitive to, you know, people who have been overpromoted or who are toiling at a job they don't like when they had a job that was maybe less prestigious or whatever, and they've abandoned that for either more money or more prestige, or you know, it looks better on a resume. I'm really sensitive to that stuff. I that stuff really speaks to me, and I don't know, as I've grown to be a pre-old guy, this stuff resonates really well. I think it plays pretty well. And honest.
I agree. So there you go, Dan.
I wanted to say one thing, Dan.
Zero for two, Dan.
You're old. Here's some glasses. Why? So, like, he's gonna get his command back. It's like you clearly see, like, he's a sad old man and he doesn't want to be in charge of everything. So he's gonna get back on the ship.
This is the exposition you need to see what will happen.
Because you saw Star Trek 4 before this.
It pays off so well with that line at the very end. Okay, can I say that the last line in the movie is not a great line? Am I alone in that opinion?
I feel young.
Yeah, it's like.
It's a little weird, and I love you know, like I said, I love this movie.
I just shot my dead friend out into space, and I feel young. And bounce off the walls, do some cartwheels.
Let's do some. You know, the other one thing I wanted to mention about the birthday thing is that as a kid, I never really it never really bothered me that they never said exactly which number birthday it is. It's fine to be vague. Later I found out that that was actually a Shatner request, that they not be deliberately, specific about which date it is, because he feared that it was a no-win scenario because of, for vanity reasons. Why date exactly what age Kirk is at that time? And by Kirk, I mean Shatner. So I just thought
Shatner
that was really interesting.
Being vain?
What? Yeah, exactly.
It's really surprising since he has a collection of hair pieces.
I didn't see those hanging on the wall. Were those in the apartment somewhere?
Right behind
the
guns.
No, they were on his head. Okay. They have this nice little conversation. We cut away to the Reliant approaching SETI Alpha 6, and they're doing some scans and stuff and blah blah blah, and there's Chekov, and he's got his captain who appears to be on all accounts a cool dude, and there is a total cast of other retired characters who are also rounding out the primary crew of the Reliant, and they all seem to be chill dudes as well, and maybe in need of retinox. they approach the planet and they're all like, hey, we found a particle of a thing. Does it need to be completely lifeless?
I mean, is their whole duty is to look for a planet, like a dead planet? I mean, that's pretty crap duty, right? I mean,
it seems like so simple. It's like, how?
Yeah.
I've got some pretty dead planets in this solar system. what more do you need? But apparently it's much more difficult outside of the solar system. And I would imagine it would be very difficult to approve funding to use the Genesis device inside of our solar system. But they go and they find the thing, and then they're like, oh, let's call Dr. Marcus, and it's like, oh, you know what she'll say. And they give her a ring, and she's like, something you could transplant. And of course, it's the office complex from the motion picture, which is the previous film, turned upside down.
Turned upside down. Classic upside down trick.
Yes.
Speaking of upside down, I guess we should talk about the Reliant design, right?
Yes. And how he signed it. He signed the approval thing. So they're like, oh, we got to flip it.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's actually kind of amazing with the Reliant design because, we got only two spaceships in this entire movie, right? And they're both Starfleet ships. And the way, I guess, ILM designed the Reliant was to have the nacelles, you got your dish and then you got your nacelles, and the nacelles are higher than the dish, just like the Enterprise. But it's a little squatter. It's definitely smaller and more compact. And I guess the Paramount executives who were going around looking at it, he was looking at it from a different, from like underneath or something, and going, oh, that would be kind of cool. And what I think turned out to be a happy accident, approving this thing upside down, I think turned out to be really good because, you really want to differentiate these two ships, and you want to quickly, within a quick thumbnail, the old squint test, and tell which, the Enterprise is iconic, yes, but you want to quickly be able to tell those ships apart. And I think that little upside down trick really did the job.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I believe, if I'm remembering correctly, and I might be wrong, that there were two designers on this project, a guy and a woman who were working together to draft the Reliant, and they drafted it and sent it for approval to Harv Bennett, who was not in the country. So they had to like send it like FedEx or something, and he signed it upside down. And so they sent back the approved design upside down, and they had to start on this, but it was upside down. So they started on it upside down, assuming that that was what he wanted. And like you said, happy accident, couldn't have been better. I think that it works in terms of both being able to distinguish the two, but also in that it gives the Reliant some menacing character for several of these shots where it's bearing down on the Enterprise. And you see sort of this muscular like roll bar across the back of it, and then the nacelles down at the side. It seems far more aggressive than it had been. Could you imagine those shots like flipped upside down? That'd be weird.
Yeah,
I think. But you are absolutely correct, Todd. I think this is an amazing happy accident. Good job. A plus.
And lots of subtle like lighting cues. I mean, they lit it much more harshly. They had deeper shadows. They had, you know, to give it a more menacing the feel. The internal lighting, I think, was much more like reds and oranges rather than the Enterprise, which has, you know, cool blues and like its main deflector dish and all that stuff. So, I mean, you know, because usually in these Star Trek films and most of these science fiction movies, when you got a, you know, these two completely different spaceships, completely different designs, one's alien and one's more humanoid, whatever, you know, like a Romulan, Klingon, bird of prey, whatever, those, nobody's going to confuse that with the Enterprise. So I thought, you know, anything to differentiate them is a good thing.
Yeah, I completely agree. Dan?
You really just want me to ruin everything, don't you?
Defend your position.
It was cool looking. It kind of reminded me of, you ever been to a place where they put that like U-shaped metal thing down on the table before they put your pizza on top of it?
Oh, God, Dan. Dan, you're fired.
Sorry.
So yes, the pizza ship.
Dan, I'm all out of size. I don't know how if I can do how many more Joe size I can do. Have I hit my quota?
I know. I'm just enjoying listening to this now because obviously you guys know all of this fascinating trivia, and I had no idea, but it all makes sense in the context, and it's interesting to hear.
Well, the thing you don't know about Star Trek fans is that when it comes down to trivia, there is nothing more.
There's nothing too arcane.
We have them beamed down to the surface. And as Dan pointed out to me, which I had never, ever, ever, ever in a million years noticed, there is some sand composited on top.
Sand, cloud, winds, whatever you want to call it. Just, yeah, we'll get in post.
Yeah. They actually had like big fans and stuff and wind and things all on set, but then they added more stuff on top of it.
Well, you can really tell they had fans on set because everyone's hair was blowing in the wind.
No, because they had helmets on.
Yeah,
Dan.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
That might have been part of the reason why they went and did this in post. But these are the two spacesuits that Kirk and Spock wore in the first movie. Have repurposed them for financial reasons so that the captain and Chekhov can walk around in them and look like silly frogs. And they find a cargo container, which seems suspiciously like, I don't know, actual cargo containers. They go down there, they poke around inside, and
it's the original tiny home, Joe.
It's the SETI Alpha tiny home. So they poke around indoors, and it's like, oh, hey, there's a lot of Shakespeare on this wall that has this buckle. Oh, my God, it says Botany Bay. Crap, let's get out of here.
Your old people problems, kids growing up in the 80s when this would rerun on TV, the pan and scan version. When Chekhov grabs that buckle and he reads Botany Bay, it's on the far right of the screen at the beginning of the shot, and then they pan over to Chekhov, and it's on the far left. But in the pan and scan version, you never see that part of the buckle. So when he's referring to Botany Bay, you have no idea what he's referring to.
Remembered where he left his keys or something is what it sounds like.
Well, it's terrible.
When I was younger, I'm like, wait a second. Is that one of the books? Because it's focused on the books. It's panned over to the books. You see Moby Dick and whatever, Shakespeare, whatever they had on the.
King Lear and.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can never see Botany Bay in the pan and scan version.
Oh, that's weird.
Yeah.
That's unfortunate. Anyway, pan and scan is terrible. Todd, would you like to take a moment and talk about pan and scan?
I would. This was an anamorphic picture. This is a 2:3:5 aspect ratio, which means 2.35 to 1 aspect ratio. Super widescreen, developed in the 50s to try to compete with television, which had a more square screen, 3x2, which is, there's many different ways to come up with that widescreen image, which we're not going to get into now because that's my day job. And then you run into a problem when you have these widescreen films. How are you going to show them on TV? Well, in the olden days, nobody would want to, say, shrink the image and show black bands at the top and bottom to show the film in its original aspect ratio. I mean, that's crazy talk. No, who would want a tiny little image? So what they would do is a special film to video transfer where they would choose a 3x2 section, a relatively square section of that widescreen, and sometimes actually have to, you know, in most shots, it would be a locked off portion of that frame, the center portion of the frame. If something's happening on the left side of frame, they would use the left side of frame. And every once in a while, if something was happening on both the left and the right side, they would either do a cut from the left side of frame and right side of frame to the right side of frame. So they would add a cut where there was never a cut before. And sometimes, most awkwardly, there would be this robotic pan left or right to accommodate, you know, to follow the action. So if somebody's handing somebody something from the left side of the frame to the right, you would actually see that. It would be this completely unnatural, you know, robotic move. And
are you saying it wasn't a nice smooth ease in, ease out? It was just a fast linear non-motion blurred move.
Yeah, it was so bad. I mean, sometimes the action would be, say, moving from left to right. So it would have its, you know, we're going to, you know, this is a technical podcast, right? We could talk about visual effects and film stuff, right?
Of course. Yeah?
Okay. So you'll sometimes have one of my favorite examples is from Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. There's this scene where Indy's up on this these catwalks, and he takes his whip and he needs to get from one catwalk to another. So he swings from a left catwalk to a right catwalk, and the camera is actually a lock-off. It's a nice, beautiful widescreen shot. He swings from the left side of the shot to the right side of the shot. There's no panning or anything. In the pan and scan version, you need to start on the left side of frame because he's right at the far left edge of the frame. And the pan and scan pans along with Indy as he moves to the right. So you have a motion blurred Indy being panned in the shot. So he's being motion blurred, but he's not moving in the frame, if you get my drift. So you it's as if he's got this weird magical blur on him. And yet the background does not have any blur. It really messes with your head. It messes with the director's intent. It messes with where your eye is supposed to, you know, look. It completely messes with the original intent of the picture. So that's why us idiots, us old jerks, were talking about letterboxing for the longest time. With letterboxing a film, which is shrinking down the image, padding it with black at the top and bottom of the screen, shows you how it was originally intended to be seen, like it was seen in the movie theater and to be seen on TV. But that was, you know, we couldn't even talk about this stuff until Laserdisc days in the late 80s. So when movies like this were shown on TV in the mid 80s and early 80s, it's like, you know, of course you're going to get the pan and scan version.
I feel like if people listening to this don't know what pan and scan is, they should turn it off because we don't want them as listeners.
Kind of, yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
Pan and scan is bad and you should feel bad. No, I've
Joe, cut all that stuff out.
I've only had to do a little bit of that where I shot some, I think it was 2.35 stuff that had to get cropped to 16:9 for broadcast. And I was just like, oh, this framing is horrible now. And everyone's going to think that I don't know how to point my camera at things. But
I have an interesting pan and scan story about this movie, actually, later in the Savick and Kirk are in the elevator together. Do you know about that shot?
I don't know about the pan and scan problems with that shot. I have other problems with that shot.
So
go ahead.
Why not? We'll just go right into it. Okay, so it's a wide shot of Savick. Savick enters the elevator, and she moves to the far left of frame. And Kirk is on the far right of frame, and they have a conversation while the elevator is going. And I think she actually stops the elevator, and they continue to talk. And it's played out in this long shot, wide, where you can see both of their expressions the entire time. You choose, you know, the viewer choose to where you want to look. You want to look at Savick. You want to look at Kirk, and they're playing off each other in real time in the same shot. And they only do a cutaway. Oh yeah, McCoy opens the doors. Who's been holding up the damn elevator? He comes in, she leaves, they continue the scene, and then only at the very end do they do like a shot reverse shot type thing. So it's actually pretty cool. You get to see the actors all playing against each other. It's all one big long take. It's really cool. So when it came time for the TV version of this movie, they were like, there is no way that we're going to be able to do a pan and scan version of this sequence, because it would be incessant cutting between two badly composed shots. It would be very bizarre to cut between the left side of frame, the right side of frame, left side. It just wouldn't have worked. So what they did was, when they actually photographed this stuff, they did do shot reverse shot. They did do close-ups of each of them saying their lines. So if you see this on TV in the, you know, olden days, you would have seen completely different performances by Kirstie Alley and Shatner for this sequence. And it was shot, reverse shot, close-ups, just traditionally shot. And I came across it on, it's on YouTube somewhere. And, you know, between takes, you could do the same words and have completely different feelings come out of the actors. And in the singles version, the close-up shots, Kirk is way more of a dick. He is such a jerk. He's being so smug and really talking down to Savick in that scene, even though it's the same lines, and he's being kind of cute in the way we all know the film. But in the single shot, it's a completely different performance, and it's an interesting take. Like it's kind of like an alternate take of what could have been that scene, and that's the kind of, you know, weird offshoots you get, like director's cut type TV version type to parallel dimensions of a movie that you can get because of issues like this.
This is why filmmakers drink.
Totally. You could just imagine them going back into like, oh god, we gotta find the film reels of this sequence. Oh, okay, they gotta cut it all together, they gotta redo all the audio, they gotta redo the score. I mean, it's kind of a nightmare.
I wonder if anyone said like letterbox it and then put a matte painting on the over the letterbox top and bottom. That would be better.
No, letterbox, people thought there were problems. I mean, the early experiments of letterbox, people were returning their videotapes back to Blockbuster saying there's something wrong with this tape. There's black bands. Why is it covering the image? And you know, education thing. I don't know. I mean, we eventually won. I mean, DVD has letterbox as a standard, you know. I mean, we eventually got around to winning, but it was a hard battle.
Yeah, I remember having those conversations with my parents at some point. Like, well, you're missing part of the frame. Like, no, you're the other version is the one that's missing.
That is the worst conversation. It's like, you don't get to see the whole thing. It's like, nope, wrong thing. Like, you get to see the whole thing. You don't understand.
It's like the conversations you have about true motion or motion smoothing, or even
shooting.
It
doesn't fill the screen.
Or even shooting your videos vertical or horizontal. I don't know. Maybe
welcome back to
phone.
Old Men Yell at a Cloud.
All right. So, speaking of old men, we have the captain and Chekhov, Captain Terrell and Chekhov, Pavel Chekhov, go, oh crap, we got to get out of here. They, instead of asking to be beamed up from where they are, try to walk outside, I guess, back to where they came from to get beamed up, which is, well, seemingly unnecessary in terms of like how transporters work, but whatever. They come across a biker gang who seem to have a robe thing going on, and they're all like,
I thought those were
Jawas. Yeah. And they're like, Houdini. And so they pull them inside, and the leader unveils, and there's a very complicated back and forth unveiling process that was designed by the guy who did all the costumes on purpose, because they wanted to go crisscross back and forth across the face to reveal who it was. It was the guy the movie is named after.
I like how he was the last one to take his helmet off too, and he was just standing in the center of the room waiting for everyone to get settled and pay attention.
Well, I mean, all those books, he knows how these things go. You know, he knows how drama works. This is the place for drama. TNT. So Khan takes off. No. Khan takes off his whole thing, and he's like, "Hey, sup, bros? I don't know you, but I never forget a face of other bros. So hey, Pavel Chekhov over there. Like, hey, sup? I remember you, even though." Pavel Chekhov was not a character who was in Space Seed, because that was not the season that anyway, it's complicated. But
so guys, this is why it's genius that you have me on the show as a guest. Joe, you're mad that Chekhov was not on the Enterprise during Space Seed.
Mad is a strong word.
Okay. Come on, you acknowledge the discontinuity and you're perturbed. Yes? It causes you a bit of strife.
I'm fine with it. I can mentally like headcanon that he was like all below right. decks or
you're
something.
You're ruining my story here. Dan couldn't care less.
I don't know what a space seed is.
Exactly. And
well, when two seeds love each other very much.
Which part is the Genesis the thing in this interaction?
We'll get to that in about an hour.
it's life from lifelessness. So, you know, pick a side.
You got a space seed 9 months later, you got a Genesis.
And mm-hmm. as a kid who never watched any of the Star Trek original series, that never bothered me. I just assumed he was on the ship.
Yeah, I don't even think I saw Space Seed until like way after I had seen this. Like I had seen other original series episodes, but the only one that I saw that I liked that I asked to see on repeat was The Trouble with Tribbles. So this wasn't that, so it didn't bother me. Are you familiar with The Trouble with Tribbles, Dan?
I'm familiar. It's in that other movie that Todd worked on.
No, that makes my non-genetically engineered blood boil.
A better answer would have been that Deep Space Nine episode.
Yes, Trials and Tribulations.
Thank you.
Sure. See, you're better at making the stupid jokes than I am.
Dan, you gotta do your research.
I'm gonna go
for
back and I'm gonna watch all of the TV show and all of the movies just so I can make bad jokes.
No, it's terrible. Don't.
No. The problem is that not only will Dan not do those things, but he'll say that that's the reason why he can't appreciate the other things is because he didn't do those other things.
Let's make it clear that Ricardo Montalban returning after 15 years. Yeah, it's one thing to get the original cast who just made a big hit movie based on their TV show to get Ricardo Montalban, who was, you know, the star of his own hit TV show that had, you know, way nothing to do with Star Trek, to come in and be this, you know, bloodthirsty villain who, and he plays the literally the nicest guy in the world who helps solve people's problems on Fantasy Island, you know, to come in and do this. It's pretty awesome. I mean, the whole movie hinges on, you know, if Montalban can do this picture or not, because if there's no Montalban, could there have been this picture? And Nicholas Meyer apparently was like, yeah, he was on board from day one. Yeah, let's do a con movie. It's great. That's saying a lot. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not like they were clamoring to put Ricardo Montalban in other films. So, you know, this is great for him. And in, you know, his role as Mr. Rourke on Fantasy Island, he doesn't really have the facilities to, I guess, stretch his legs, like to eat all of the scenery.
To flex his muscles and or pecs?
Yes. His muscular pecs.
His real pecs, yeah.
Yeah, real pecs.
Are you saying it wasn't one of those plastic things that you buy at Halloween time to make it look like you have abs?
No.
All real, but baby.
It was heavily rumored for a long time that was the case, but everyone and their grandmother who worked on it was like, nope, totally the real thing.
Well, he had that really thick necklace on the whole time, so it's a perfect place to hide a seam for something like that.
Well, I think it's just because mainly he looked kind of, I don't know, maybe it was like a sun damage kind of a thing, like a little Corinthian leathery, but it wasn't like
rich Corinthian leather.
Exactly what I was going for. But, so Dan, Ricardo Montalban, he's great, and I love him.
He is great. No, he gives 110% in this movie, and he's fully bought into his role, and He says a lot of lines that I think I've heard you say before that I didn't realize were lines from this movie.
Yes. And Dan, how many scenes does Ricardo Montalban share with William Shatner?
In the same room?
Yes. How many scenes does he share with William Shatner in the same room?
I'm going to go with zero.
Exactly. A whole film like this where they're mortal enemies fighting with one another. And not a single time do they talk to one another face-to-face.
I mean, you could have a pretty serious argument over FaceTime, but Yeah, I guess it's easier when you're in person.
Yeah, well, it's really interesting, especially when you find out that the entire time Ricardo Montalban was acting, he was acting against a script supervisor or script understudy supervisor, something like that, who some nice little person who and could not emote exactly what William Shatner was saying,
yeah.
Who was saying very nice things back to Khan when he was trying to be serious.
With a movie like that, I mean, and that was one of the biggest concerns that Shatner, Montalban, all the studio executives, everybody had about this, that the villain and the hero never are in the same room together. And no, you know, very few modern movies would have the guts to pull off a movie like this where they're never even in the same room and they're always doing video and audio chatting. Come on, nobody's going to be able to do that.
Well, when you've got super strength guy versus regular human, you think that'll probably play out pretty much as expected. So they kind of, you know, circumvented that.
But Dan, you didn't see Space Seed where they fought.
I saw the one that Todd did where they fought on that moving car thingy that was in the air. So you're not out of size.
Yeah, no, I found a reserve.
You reached down deep and you found the auxiliary.
Rosenstiel Supply just dropped off a big ton of them. I got a whole big pack of them. But one of the things, I mean, there's a high level of movie magic going on here that these guys are never in the same room at the same time, and yet you feel the conflict so well. Add to the fact that Montalban, they never shot simultaneously. I mean, I could see somebody today trying to rig up the two sets on the same soundstage and try to actually do video conferencing so they can actually act against each other. You know what I'm saying? So they could do video conferencing and riff off each other and actually improvise a little bit. But not only they had to shoot all of Montalban's stuff first because of his schedule to get back to Fantasy Island.
I was going to say, was there a personality conflict that had anything to do with this, or is it just scheduling?
No, scheduling and the fact that the Reliant Bridge and the Enterprise Bridge, that's the same
bridge.
That's the same damn stage. It's been redressed and, you know, relit, but it's literally the same spot. They're standing in the same spot. And it's really cool movie magic with all the editing and the sound effects and the music and the static and the pauses.
They're standing
really cool
in the same exact spot yelling at each other through a parallel universe. No, wait, that's the other ones.
Well, I mean, anyway, I'm not going to get into antimatter, Kirk, but so these specifics of this episode, movie, where we were before we went on our journey was back on SETI Alpha 5, which Ricardo Montalban had just revealed himself, and he says, you know, hey, bros, this is SETI Alpha 5, not SETI Alpha 6, and stuff, and like all of the stuff that you see here, this whole thing. This is all SETI Alpha 5. And Chekhov's like, well, on SETI Alpha 5, this is life and things. And you shouldn't have done that. Like, Captain Kirk did you a solid by dropping you off on, I don't know, a planet for you to rule. let's not get into the specifics of Space Seed and, like, dropping people off on penal colony things and stuff.
And apparently
weird.
Never, ever checking in on them in 15 years and leaving it off the record books. I mean, that's a dick move.
Also, like, when you go into a planetary system that is numbered, maybe count the planets. Where are you being down?
Well, that Reliant crew, you know, there's a reason why they're out looking for dead planets.
Yeah, like that's not your A team there.
Exactly.
So they go out there and they have this conversation, and Khan is nonplussed by learning that Kirk has gone on to become Admiral Kirk. Admiral Kirk.
Admiral.
Yes. He is so good at it. I love it. He's incredulous about it. And they talk about this for a bit, and Captain Sherrill is like, I've never met Admiral Kirk. Like, I don't know anything about him. Like, what the F are you involving me in all this for? And he's a criminal. And Montalban's like, you know, you never told your captain the tale to amuse your captain. It's really great stuff. And then he pulls out the thing from the sandy little box that has the stuff, and it has like a back with the little scale things and has little things inside of it, and he tweezers it. It's a really long scene.
It's a really long, a lot of exposition there.
It is. Honest to God, it is a long scene, but I enjoy it, but I don't know if that's because I saw it when it wouldn't maybe have bothered me as much that it was a long scene, but Dan, ruin my expectations and explain to me how the scene is too long and boring for
you. No, it's not that it was, I wouldn't say that it's long and boring, but when he went to the, you never told him this story that I'm about to say out loud because we're in a movie and everyone needs to know this story, I did roll my eyes a little bit, but of course it's just, you know, exposition and the nature of it, but.
To amuse your captain.
Right. You know, just say it now. The camera's here. Don't look at the camera. They're watching right now. But say the story.
Well, okay. To compare it to itself in terms of franchise stuff, isn't this a more elegant way of kind of letting the fans or, you know, audience who has never heard of Space Seed or never saw the episode, isn't this a more elegant way of introducing the Khan character than, say, Star Trek 3 or was it 4? Where they're literally watching security footage.
Oh, that was 3, where they're watching the playback of how he did the memory imprint from 2.
Which is literal shots from the previous movie. I mean, this is
from movie narrator cam somewhere positioned exactly. In the upper deck.
Oh, those are my favorite security cameras that are like waist high. Shot with an anamorphic lens.
Oh, well. Yeah. Whenever they cut to security footage, which is like on a steady cam and is roving around and oh, jeez.
Anyway, so I enjoy the scene and I feel like it has a significant amount of tension with the little things from the eel thing that he pulls off with the tweezer things and puts in the bowl. And then he drops them into the helmets and puts them on their heads. And, you know, you get some screaming, a little Texas Chainsaw Massacre screaming in excess, but not that bad, really. They crawl along their faces with the little wire being pulled, and they're in goo, so they kind of trail along behind them, but,
Oh, I thought it was pretty great that he said, in 1996 from when the year that they were frozen.
Oh, yes. I forgot that.
It was a good year. Where all of his passion came from, 1996.
It was not really a year where we had eugenics wars that we know of, but there are books that have contorted themselves into trying to make up a scenario where that happened.
Well, it could have coexisted. This was in a galaxy far, far away, right?
Not so much.
All right.
I'm going to need some more size. Can we bring that truck back in here?
I'll send it to you in the Slack.
Another one? Okay, thanks. Sorry, guys. What are we talking about here?
Can we get it in XL?
Can we talk about Khan's boys for a second and boys and girls, his crew?
It's weird, isn't it, that he's the only old guy?
Well, he is young. Which is, I'm buying that. But, you know, after 15 years of being on that planet, I'm guessing they didn't, you know, have any birth control on that, you know, that life pod. No kids? No kids around? I don't know. Kind of bothered me.
Okay.
Well, I mean, you know, maybe when you're just in a room full of 20 people and you don't have a lot of privacy, it's a little difficult.
Might get comfortable with that after the first couple of years.
You don't want to be like, hey, Susie, let's sneak out into the fractal noise windstorm and, you know, have some alone time.
Here's a nice touch I really liked when they put the little eels in the two helmets. The guy with Chekhov's helmet, he's kind of, well, Khan's is giving this like really scary speech. The guy's holding the helmet and he's about to put it on Chekhov's head. But before he does, he's kind of like rotating it around, kind of playing with it like, yeah, this is going to cause some real damage. I don't know. It's like a nice little detail.
Do you notice that nice little detail, Dan?
We had to wake Dan up from that scene.
No, I wasn't looking at him. I was looking at Ricardo, this being my first viewing. So I wasn't looking at the background player.
Well, I mean, you should look at Ricardo because he is eating the scene.
I mean, he is a little bit like the staring into the sun. You have to look away from time to time, but not very often.
No, he is magnificent. I think this is probably one of my smaller problems with the Star Trek Into Darkness film, which we're not going to harp on the whole entire duration of this podcast, but...
Are you sure?
Probably not. So it's like Benedict Cumberbatch, I like, as Sherlock in the Sherlock things. And Ricardo Montalban, I like as Khan. And Benedict Cumberbatch as Khan, I don't like so much. But maybe that's because I have seen Khan so much. But Dan hasn't seen Khan so much. So, Dan, Benedict Cumberbatch or Ricardo Montalban?
That's such a hard comparison to make. They're incredibly different characters.
Yes, they are.
I think Ricardo works great as an 80s bad guy. I don't think Cumberbatch would have worked very well in this movie, and vice versa if you were to swap the two. But they're very different characters. And
yes, please choose between the Mexican playing the Sikh or the British guy, extremely white badger looking British guy.
I mean,
playing a Sikh.
Cumberbatch did a great job of generating some genuine tears in a couple of those scenes. He really went for it too, in a different direction, of course.
Well, crying is hard. So they go through this process, and you know, at the end of this very very scene, Ricardo Montalban's like, "Now, tell me where I might find James T. Kirk." And we cut back to the launch of the Enterprise, and it's like, "Hey, we got a ship that can go places." And this is all stock footage from the previous film where they had the Enterprise go out of the space dock for like 20 minutes. It was an absurd amount of time. Dan, you might think that I hate you by making you watch a Star Trek film, but if I really hated you, I probably would have made you watch Star Trek the Motion Picture first. But I don't.
Was it just all slow motion leaving space dock stuff?
Not Star Trek V first?
not Star Trek Nemesis? No, but so they leave this dock, and it takes an interminable amount of time.
And the one thing that has, you know, the thing about Star Trek Motion Picture is that the space dock sequence is probably 45 minutes long. And the shots are beautiful. The models are beautiful. The lighting is stunning. Jerry Goldsmith's music is fantastic. But it just drags. It's one of the main, you know, one of the iconic criticisms of the motion picture. It is just so draggy and so it's like paying homage to something and then paying homage to it and then paying homage to it some more, and it's totally overboard. Whereas this space dock sequence, you know, when I the first time I saw it, I didn't know these were cribbed shots. Horner's score over the cutting of this stuff I thought worked really well and was very efficient. But I could see folks who were big fans of the motion picture or who even knew the motion picture going to this and going, "Oh, boy, I sure hope this doesn't lead to a reputation for the Star Trek series of cribbing footage from previous films in order to save money."
Yeah, I don't even think they stopped doing that until Star Trek Generations, because they
that's
had
the joke.
They had still, thanks, Todd. They had still reused the explosion of a bird of prey from the previous movie in that movie. Yep. It is. And any time they can save money in Star Trek, they save money. And it's so sad. But in this particular case, I feel like if you hadn't seen the previous movie, you'd be like, "Okay, this is fine."
Yeah.
They had cut together a sequence that results in the ship leaving the dock and it not taking too terribly long. And it's still having sort of a uplifting feel about this cadet piloting them out of the dock.
In fact, that shot of it finally leaving space dock, where we're kind of looking up at the Enterprise, and the camera kind of pans left and it kind of spins around, and I just love the majesty of that shot. And that was one of the motion picture Doug Trumbull shots. I adored that shot, and it was I did the of the 2009 film. I did the last shot of the movie, which is this big fly around of the Enterprise, and then it finally goes into warp. That shot was definitely my touchstone. I wanted to make it feel as weirdly optical as that, like something we actually photographed, but to have that majesty, that was my touchstone for that one.
Yes. Yeah, so Dan, tell us what you don't like.
Space dock was fine. It was slow. It took too long. I don't care. It's fine. Who cares?
All right. They come on the Enterprise.
I liked your shot from the newer one though.
Okay. Also, when they
I take back one sigh.
when they board the ship, they board through the like little torpedo bay side door thing instead of the back shuttle bay thing that they did in the previous film. They go into the shuttle bay, the torpedo bay, and they have the redressed set of the Klingon bridge from the previous film designed as the torpedo room. Where they dispatch the torpedoes from slowly and one at a time. And that
was a big fight. And Nicholas Meyer really wanted to have that manual torpedo bay because the whole thing is that the connection that he had with Star Trek is that this was Horatio Hornblower. He wanted to have like ships at sea, and he wanted to have that tactile feeling of loading the guns. And so he fought really hard to have this set built or repurposed for as a torpedo bay. And his compromise was, we're going to do a lot of scenes in this movie in that little set, which is when they arrive, when they do all of the torpedo launching, and the big pivotal funeral scene, spoiler alert, at the end of the movie. So I think it worked out pretty well.
Is this the one with the really slow moving door to try and separate the two corridors?
I guess that's engineering, right? That's what you're talking about.
Oh, yeah. It's when the guy's like slowly crawling on the ground trying to get under the
door. Yeah. And they put the door through the warp core.
Yes.
That one.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll get to that.
Yeah.
But Todd is correct. That this is how they tried to justify it, and yes, it was good to have this, like, for dramatic reasons, not for like torpedo dispatching reasons. Yeah. Like, it doesn't make any sense. But you know, for drama, it works. So much so that Nicholas Meyer would revisit this when he went back to direct Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, which is what he wanted to originally title this mm-hmm. film, but they were like, no, that's a weird title. So it was The Wrath of Khan. But
which is what Wrath of Khan, yeah, that was a studio executive came up with that, and somebody else at the studio wanted to call it Revenge of Khan. And you know why they shied away from that?
Nicholas Meyer. Revenge of the Sith.
Yeah. come on, do better. You got it. 1982, Revenge of the. Come on,
you got it. You're a Star Wars fan.
Jedi, Joe. It's Jedi.
Thank you, Dan. Revenge of the Jedi.
Yeah, that was the title of the third Star Wars.
That's what
film.
I meant to say before I said Sith, because mm-hmm. that was the third movie mm-hmm. from the thing. Mm-hmm. But then it just bleached my brain. Mm. Sorry.
I just think it's funny that they shied away from Revenge of Khan because of the fact that George Lucas was going to name his Star Wars movie Revenge of the Jedi. Now you almost had me saying it. Ultimately, they changed the title back to Return of the Jedi, and Star Trek stuck with The Wrath of Khan. And I guess there were a lot of folks at Paramount were like, nobody knows what the word wrath means. Don't call it that. And,
it's not as bad as insurrection. But so they, which you know, on multiple levels. But so they go through this process. Kirk's on board, and then he goes through engineering, and they're like, "Hey, midshipman Peter Preston, first class, what's up, bro?" And Kirk's like, "Oh, this is so impressive. What a interesting person. And in the director's cut, you find out that this is actually Scotty's nephew. In the actual theatrical cut, you don't know any of that. So why Scotty cares so much about this one person seems weird for many people who watch the theatrical cut. But if you watch the director's cut, you're like, oh, his poor nephew died.
Oh, this is the guy he carries up to the bridge for some reason?
Yes, the guy who he's like, I will get first-class medical treatment on the bridge.
On the bridge. I mean, that's a court-martial, like, class offense, right? To get
maybe he didn't really like his nephew.
Leave your post. You know what I'll do? I'll bring this lifeless corpse to the bridge.
That shot, that's so bad. That should not have been there. As soon as that door opened, he's just standing there holding the dead guy. It's just like, well, no.
It's
go put him back.
We're not going to talk about Scotty, you know, apparently having, you know, the clap or something from shore leave, right? That's what they're implying, right?
Oh, I never interpreted it that way.
I had a wee bout, sir.
I thought that when he was saying that, it was just like that he was a workaholic and that he was, you know, not working. And
sailor
so that
on shore
he was recovering
leave.
From that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Just wanted to. Different perspectives. It's in the mind of the viewer.
So, Dan, do you think it was the clap?
No, I think that for me, it sort of sounded like the thing that they've been harping on for all these guys is we're old and we need we shouldn't be in the main service. We need time off and that kind of junk.
That kind of junk. Okay, so Kirk is like later with the rest of the inspection. Oh, I want to do it later. Let's get out of here. Nice skedaddle.
I really want to ride this elevator right now. We'll do it later.
Yes.
Can I make a quick comment about the Vulcan, the Savik and Spock speaking Vulcan together?
Please do.
So I like that scene. I think it's cute. It's, you know, he's never what I expect. And he's so human. And what's Spock's line? Is like, nobody's perfect or something.
Oh, so this is a question I have. Were there supposed to be subtitles for that part of the movie? Because there weren't subtitles in that part of the movie.
Netflix.
Yeah. So, yeah, I thought this was fixed. And I noticed this is on Netflix streaming, right? So, Dan, you watched it tonight?
I watched it tonight on Netflix, yes.
And it had no subtitles.
No subtitles. I went and turned on subtitles and it just said, in parentheses, in Vulcan.
That had been fixed at one point. And apparently it's broke again. Okay, that's good to know.
When they took it off the service and re-added it to the service, they broke it again.
So yeah, that's supposed to have subtitles and it's a pretty good sequence. Anyway, so I actually don't know if that was an afterthought of them speaking Vulcan or in English, because if you look at their lips, they're saying those lines in English. They're just saying those lines. And it's all ADR. You know, not great ADR, but you know, it's 1982, almost all ADR stunk back then. But if you look carefully at their lips, they are saying the lines as printed in the English subtitles. Sorry, Dan. I don't know if you knew anything about that, Joe, or not, but I just think it's an interesting little piece.
Yeah, they originally said it in English and then they had them come back and do it in Vulcan, quote unquote. And they had the guy who would go on to do the Klingon language before he did that for Star Trek 3. He did it for Star Trek 2 here with the Vulcan language, where he tried to make what they were saying make sense. So he had the constraint of what they had said on set and then trying to reverse engineer how that would be a language from that, but still sound alien. So that's interesting.
I can't believe that Netflix screwed. Oh man,
I can believe it. I can totally believe it because I noticed it the first time. But anyway, they borked it, and they borked it again. So good job, everyone. If you have the chance to get your hands on a copy of the director's cut, I do recommend it over the copy of the theatrical cut. And it might be a slight investment if you care about this film. So grabs it for your personal possessions.
At least Netflix angered a pretty laid-back group of people who are not at all fanatical about their their franchise.
No one cares about details in Star Trek, Dan.
So, I feel like you guys know more about this movie than I know about any other movie I have ever seen.
Probably.
Could be.
So they say later, they peel out of there. They go to Disco Speed, and we have the whole thing with, you know, Carol Marcus and Regula, and it's like, hey, you know, that Boy Scout and stuff, and they're gonna come steal the thing, you know, and she's like, he was never a Boy Scout, and it's like, LOL, that's hilarious, because we know Kirk, and this guy, David, does not, LOL, hilarious, hilaire, as the kids say. Dan, I'll tell did you find that hilarious?
My 8-year-old loved that line. He was never a Boy Scout. She laughs and laughs. She loves that line.
The David character was very whiny. He was very, but Ma, and you could kind of see the thing coming from a mile away. Or at least I could.
Todd, I like your 8-year-old more than Dan. Is your 8-year-old available to record on a weekly basis? But anyway,
no, I was totally fooled by it. I didn't see it coming at all. Is that better?
No, that's not better. But so, and anyway, they have their little exchange about the things and the stuff, and how should I put this? Kirk is just on another training mission, and they are like, hey. Well, what's up? There's a thing that we should go do with the stuff. And they're like, it would help if you explained what the stuff was. And then they're like, hey, come on down. I'm going to show you what the stuff is. And he shows them a video of what Proto Pixar made.
He actually calls it a tape. Kirk calls it a tape. A tape.
Yes.
Tape. I thought tape. That was awesome.
Yes. Because that's what you want running through the bowels of your starship is magnetic tape. It's the only way to really be sure that you have the correct amount of archival footage of people saying things.
Would you say he was able to conjure up the data tapes?
Good try.
That was
these ones weren't stolen, so I had to improvise. I'm sorry.
I appreciate your effort, Dan.
He's trying. He's trying.
It is noted on your log.
Thank you.
I'm making a mark right here.
Gold star on my next report card.
Oh, gold. I don't know about that.
I find red. I like the red ones.
It's more like gray. I think it's great that, you know, I think one of the nice things, one of the more adult things of this movie is that they've waited this long to explain what Genesis is. There's a lot of discussions about Genesis. There's the Reliant looking for a planet. There's all the stuff that Carol Marcus does in the on their Regular One and all this stuff. And finally, you know, audience surrogate of Spock and McCoy, like, what the heck is Genesis? And here, okay, finally, let me sit down and show you some really cool Pixar computer animation. I don't know. I think that was kind of cool.
I don't think audiences these days are as patient with exposition.
Yes.
I know for a fact that when I try to show things to my boyfriend, that sometimes he's like, tell me what it is. And I'm like, can you wait like 10 seconds? And they'll talk about it in the film that we're watching. And then it's like, but I don't want to wait 10 seconds. And it's like, just please. And then they explain it. And then it's just like, see, they did the thing. They said the thing. They said what it was. Isn't that amazing? And I feel like with Star Trek II, The Wrath of God, that the wait might be inexorable for some people, but I find it to be totally adequate for me. Like, I'm fine not immediately having the answers of what Genesis is right off the bat. Mm-hmm. And I think that the way it is revealed is okay. It's not the best. I mean, they're still watching like test footage of an experiment of a thing. Like, it's not like it's not completely organic the way it is revealed through, you know, subtle things happening through everyday life, but it's it's fine for me.
But the sequence does have one of the weirdest cuts in the entire movie when Smug Kirk is kind of leaning over his console and he's trying to conjure up the data tapes. Wow, you got me saying it. and it says, prepare for retina scanner. What's your name? And he's like, Kirk. Admiral James T. And he's like, he's got this, it's a wide shot, and he's got this little smile on his face. Cut to a close-up of Shatner looking, like, nervous and sweaty. And it's this fisheye lens, and it's the insert shot of his eye getting scanned with retina scan.
And his mouth is open for some reason. It's like they're totally not scanning your mouth, dude.
He's like, maybe he was expecting a swab of the cheek for DNA. But yeah, it's a great cut. It's a totally bizarre cut.
Well, I mean, when you're a Kirk, you're always expecting a swap of bodily fluids. But so
he's like, another paternity test.
So they have the thing, and we get our first glimpse at early computer animation being used in a film. And like Dan said, this is something that he has seen repeatedly over and over and over again. And if you are at all familiar with computer effects being used in films, you've seen this in the historical, you know, archives of, like, this is what started it all. Like, this is, like, the big thing, the big reveal. Like, the things that they had done before were, like, wireframes and stuff. And, like, this is, hey, computer effects in a thing. Ta-da. So, it's not super impressive for a modern audience to see it, but at the same time,
no,
you can
but
kind
it
of...
it reads as a simulation pretty well. It reads as a demonstration, and that's what they had going for them, is that maybe I'm wrong, but every time I read a description of the process of making this part of the film, it seemed like they were going for complete photorealism, which I think maybe I'm just reading into it, but the simulation aspect, the demonstration aspect of it is what they had going for them. And the, you know, like, I don't know, lack of motion blur or whatever, all the camera moves are so interesting and dynamic, but it plays perfectly well, even to modern audiences, as a demonstration. I think it really works.
Yeah, I think it works as a demo, especially in like a simulation context, because it wasn't something they actually had done. But the thing about it was that when they were in development, this was originally, they weren't sure how they were going to do it, and this was originally going to be like a microwave box that they put like a rock in, and then a light came on, and then like stuff started growing on it through dissolves. So just to give you some idea of where the minds of cinema were in 1982, like, that was a top-notch solution for this that competed with this other thing.
Like,
so,
they went to the guy who did the Wolfman effects or something?
Yeah, exactly. It's like, if you're like, well, you know, this isn't, like, super amazing, this is, like, a photo, a reel, then I would encourage you to consider what the alternatives for the era were when it was made. So it more than excels, in my opinion. And if you have a chance, watch on YouTube the video that's narrated by Alvy Ray Smith, because he has an amazing Texan accent. So it is enjoyable to listen to.
And one thing that they did not have going for them is that it's one uninterrupted shot. And they apparently rendered it all as one interrupted shot, even though they do in the edit cut back to the Kirk, Scott, Spock and McCoy, you know, fascinating or something like that. That's one long shot. And as anybody who has, you know, worked on these like minute long shots before, that it gets unwieldy really fast. And that, you know, they set a high bar right off the bat to do that kind of rendering.
I agree. So Dan, defend your position.
It was fine. It looks great. It was 1982. Let's move on.
Okay. So then we have Kirk and Spock and McCoy doing what they do best. And we have the triumvirate of the three of them discussing the morality of what they have seen depicted. And Spock weighs in with what is logical, what is, you know, science, what is without the, you know, any of the messiness of feeling, what makes sense. And we have McCoy solely with messiness of feeling, and we have Kirk somewhere between the two trying to weigh them. And I think that is one of the things that really brings this movie together, is you have that like trio of the three of them talking about this.
Dan was unimpressed.
No, McCoy really went for it. You could see that he went straight for the moral center of this and what should be right and wrong and all that.
He immediately got pissed off. He's right. You know, the tape hadn't even been done playing, and he was ready to go. Like, he was already thinking about the
universal implications of even remotely using this one time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he's from the South, but not to be a horrible person, but he's like, suppose you use this where life already exists, and then you wipe all that life that you don't necessarily like out, and you replace it with life that you do like. And
I mean, earlier in the film, we had Chekhov like turning around going, does it have to be completely lifeless?
don't worry about it, guy. We got our best team on it. We got the Reliant looking around for a dead planet. It's cool.
But you know, so on the one hand, you have maybe we can completely wipe out someone we don't like and replace them either with someone we do like or with conditions to support someone we do like, or just merely to undermine someone we don't like. But it is an amazing weapon if you think about it that way, which is something that the sequel to this movie goes to explore in great detail. But for the purposes of this, they have this brief discussion about this, and they're like, hey, so maybe there's bad stuff about using this. And then it's like, well, yeah, so what? What's your point? And it's like, hey, Reliance in our sector and closing. And so they all go up to the bridge. And it's like, oh, wait, I thought you were the only ship in the quadrant. Or what are quadrants? Or how does this work? But whatever. And then they are like trying to raise them on the thing. And it's like, oh, no, something has overloaded their comm things and then stuff. And then it's like, well, that seems like it's bad. Maybe we should run with their shields down. And then it's like, yeah, so that's great. And then Savick's like, maybe don't do that. And Kirk's like, I know what I'm doing. I'm aware of regulations and stuff. And then, you know, that was stupid because then immediately Khan fires and kaboom, the stuff explodes and things explode and the things are not good. And downstairs, the door slides through the middle of the warp core.
That shield graphic on both, I think, the Enterprise and the Reliant ends up being a really important prop for the movie, because you to understand what shields are and that boop 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 boop, boop the dots surrounding the wireframe of the ship, that turns out to be very important. And the way that scene cuts together of Khan kind of trying to wait for exactly the right moment to fire to turn on his own shields, and then Kirk finally figuring it out, and then when the firing begins, the pacing of the editing is quickening, and Horner's score is getting really revved up. I don't know, that stuff's really great.
I love it. Dan, defend your position.
No, I think this is the instance where I mentioned earlier that I actually did notice the score and it was adding a lot to the scene.
Oh, so you feel like the scene couldn't have stood on its own without the score?
Correct. Sure. Those words.
Okay. So Dan,
tell me, Joe, what's my next opinion?
So your next opinion is that it's ridiculous the way that when the explosions happen, the guy flies across the stage like he is somehow jumping through the air.
Yeah, they do some nice tilting of the set, because I guess the gravity, they're falling to the side and people are flying. Yeah.
Okay. And so they cut through the warp core with the door thing that closes slowly, and they're all like scrambling around trying to get to their positions and stuff. And it's like, whoa, what do we do? Oh, man, they knew exactly where to hit us. These LEDs are lighting up like crazy.
And I love how Spock is like, let's find out where they hit us. And there's all these points that are flashing on the map. and Spock points at the flashing things. It's like, okay, yeah, thank you for pointing out
what these are flashing. The ones that are flashing. FYI.
I love that. I think there's all these like little passive aggressive things that Spock does to Kirk. He's like, if you can't notice it look, right here,
it's
right
like,
here.
It's like Galaxy Quest. The red dot's getting closer to the green dot.
Exactly, Dad. You're finally maybe starting to come around to this, that you see Galaxy Quest
I like Galaxy Quest. What are you talking about? Don't retcon this now.
Well, no, I'm just saying that you understand how Galaxy Quest fits into Star Trek.
Oh, okay, sure.
Is good.
Clearly, the more Star Trek I see, the more I'll appreciate Galaxy Quest. Yeah, I'll go with that.
Exactly. Because it's not important that you appreciate Star Trek. It is important that you appreciate Galaxy Quest. But they have their exchange about how they knew exactly where to hit us. And they're coming around. Oh, phasers. Too late. Kaboom. And then everything shakes a little. And then it's like, well, who did this? And crap, what's going on? And then Khan is on the screen. And this is, of course, where we get to the cutting back and forth between things that were filmed wildly differently apart from one another. And Nicholas Meyer has said that in order to get Shatner to provide a convincing performance in certain takes, that he would just make Shatner just say the same thing over and over again and just keep cutting and just saying redo it. And that was his tactic for getting Shatner to be less Shatner-y every time.
Well, he's got that great story in the book about the line, here it comes, when they Kirk and company come up with a plan behind Khan's back that they're going to be able to fire upon them. And the Khan goes, okay, time's up. Send over the Genesis data, and there's in a big dramatic close-up, Kirk looks at almost at the camera and says, okay, Khan, here it comes. And every single take, Shatner was just laying it on so thick with a big smirk or a big like knowing wink or you know whatever. And like you said, Joe, Meyer just had him going over it and over it and over it. And I think that was the most number of takes they did until, as Meyer wrote, Shatner was bored with the scene. And that's like the best understated Kirk came out when Shatner was bored with the scene. This is not like a blanket, you know, one way to direct William Shatner thing. This is just for that scene on that day. That is what worked great. And, you know, in the cut, worked great.
I agree. It worked great. It was one of the most like almost shockingly understated moments that he had, that, you know, most of that performance was he was trying to be slightly subdued because he didn't want to tip his hat. But yeah, that particular line, you can definitely see where he would go way overboard if you let him.
Yeah. And like you could see how he didn't exactly get the timing right when it was like, Genesis, what's that?
Exactly. Exactly my point. That was like a take one.
Yeah, so I feel.
So wait, does Starfleet make back doors into their own software? This is timely, right?
Yeah, well, you just need what like happened? The 6-digit 2-factor authentication code to get in.
What happened was the FBI said no more encrypted software, so we have to have keys to everything.
That was 1997. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what set it all off right before the eugenics war.
And you enter it by flipping switches like binary.
So they flip the switches and the shields go down and there is fists on consoles and where's the override? It's very dramatic and I love the way the scene plays out and it is nice because it is an example of how Kirk and Spock's experience can win out over Khan's intellect but inexperience with dealing with ship-to-ship Federation versus Federation battles. So I feel like that really plays out very well. I like how that gels together. And then they blow the crap out of him and hit the little impulse crystal thing. And then, you know, strings and stuff fall from the ceiling. And it's like, that was bad. And they peel out of there, and they're like, ta-da! And then it's like swoops over the top, ta-da! It's a big thing, and they leave.
There's a lot of post camera shake on this sequence. Do you guys pick that up, I'm sure? Yes?
Yes.
No? Yeah. And it's one of those things where if you haven't noticed it, I've just ruined it for you, because it's it's a lot of it's like the same like it's a horizontal, completely horizontal camera shake that is like the same, you know, in modern terms, it's a 15 frame loop of keyframes that is the same ones over and over and over again. You know, in context, it works. It works pretty well because it's a lot of Dutch angles, especially on the Reliant ship. But yeah, once you kind of see that it's a, yeah, it kind of ruins the illusion of it.
Okay, so it wasn't that I was noticing in the one camera shake scene that when I saw the top edge of the matte box or whatever the frame. That was a matte box, not like camera shake.
Yeah. Yeah, you saw the matte box. I know the shot you're talking about.
I didn't bother to pause and frame by frame to see exactly what it was, but it's like, hey, there's some black at the top of that frame.
It's okay. That stuff is fine. It's texture.
You'll live, Dan. So they get out of there, and it's like, oh, crap. They're dead people, and they're on the bridge for some reason. And let's go down to sick bay. And then they go down there, and the more people who are suffering and stuff. And then midshipman Peter Preston, first class, is the word given? And yes, the word is given. Warp speed. And then he croaks. And this, again, is more dramatic if you know that Scotty and the guy are totally related and not like just strangers, and he cared about him for some reason.
But that's a sweet admiral move right there. Just a, you know, the dying cadet, you know, you get admiral right there, and he's telling him the word is given, warp speed. He's, you know, a big smile on his face. I mean, that's a good way to go.
Yeah, a better way to go would be, hey, I raised the shields when it seemed like there was a ship coming who couldn't talk to us.
Yeah.
But I didn't do that.
Or McCoy, you know, offhandedly saying, you know, if you had brought him right to sick bay at the beginning, I could have saved his life instead of bringing him up to the bridge.
Maybe that's why McCoy was so quick to, like, put the tinfoil blanket over him.
He was really fast with the body bag, yeah.
Yeah, he was like, yep, donezo. And then he, like, drags that across the top.
It's passive aggression against Scotty.
Yes. It's just like, why would you go to somebody else other than me? Like, I am your primary physician.
Take him to 10 forward, too.
So that is a joke that is lost on Dan. But that is a place on a thing, on a ship thing. But so they have a thing, and he's like, I got caught with my britches down. It's like, not good for britches. And so they go to Regula, and on Regula, they find that there are not many things happening, and there is just Uhura's voice looping over and over on monitors and stuff, and there are oval screens, because that's the future. And they wander around for a bit, and there's a lab rat, because it's a lab, so you gotta have one.
My 8-year-old asked, why are there rats on that ship? I'm like,
it's a nice jump scare.
It is. I'm just to go back a little bit when they're about to beam over to the regular one. Jim, be careful. Spock says, Jim, be careful. And McCoy comes in and says, we will. Boy, my 8-year-old loves that line.
McCoy is an amazingly cantankerous person who I adore, but I'm glad that your 8-year-old also adores McCoy.
My note about Regula One is so much Euro style, the font. It's just everywhere.
Yeah, and like beige and like, what would you call that other color? Like a brown?
Like muddy maroon? I don't know. Yeah.
It is an unflattering color palette. Yeah. Also, every single electrical prop that you could rent for the next 30 years is in this scene.
Yeah.
Anytime you did a B movie or a sci-fi B movie or a television series or something, there is bound to be something from this scene in that, because these were all rented. Especially those two tube things with the red beam things that spin around. You know what I'm talking about.
Yep.
Yeah,
there was an airplane too. As they actually made a prop out of it.
They are in everything, and it is amazing to me, and it somehow cheapens this film that you see them elsewhere. Yeah. Because it's like you guys didn't spend enough money to make this unique in any possible way.
To Dan's point about the jump scare that happens after the rat, it's a really classic movie technique of like, okay, well, we first we had the scare of the rat, and it's like, oh wow, everything's fine, and slowly all of the noise, all of the sound effects start to get drained away, all the score starts to drain away until there's just no sound. And McCoy's walking backwards, and then the big super stinger of the dead bodies, which is, you know, kind of crazy, horrific, but just classic little movie moment there.
Yeah, it's not particularly inventive, but it is fun, and it's well executed. And if you are not like super into film stuff, you will be like, that is cool. Dan, did it work on you as an effective jump scare when you were like, oh no, dead people?
Yeah, it did. Although I'm kind of like allergic to jump scares that these days.
Do you take medication?
Yes, I take medication that causes me to roll my eyes at jump scares. But no, it worked. They always work. That's the point of them.
Well, that's what Red Knox 5 is for. But so the thing is that... that works, and they cut them down, and it's like, why did Kirk go up there to cut them down from the thing, and why were they strung up like that? That's weird. And then Savick finds the safe that has life science inside of it, which is apparently somehow difficult for everyone else in the world to find until this moment, and they open it to find Captain Terrell and Chekhov, who are like, were like passed out. But not really. And then they're like, hey, let's talk to you about things and stuff, about, you know, like cons and things and stuff. And so they're like, yeah, he's completely mad, Admiral. He blames you for his wife. And he's like, I know what he blames me for. And it's like, you could be less of a jerk to Captain Terrell. I feel like that would be fine. Captain Kirk, Admiral Kirk. But,
The Paul Winfield's Terrell. Can we just talk about that? I mean, this is a relatively bit part, but he brings a lot of humanity to that role, and it's not an easy role. I mean, he's not given that much to work with, but I don't know. Terrell seems to be a fully fleshed like human being, and you see the battle in him when he's holding Kirk at gunpoint, and he's battling the alien inside of him, and you hear Kirk, Khan on the comm telling him to do stuff. I thought Winfield, you know, who later did at least one more Star Trek appearance, probably more.
Yeah, he was Captain Dathan in
Darmok?
Darmok, exactly.
Yeah. But I think he did a great job on that.
Yeah, I like him a lot, and I really like the casting of him, and I think that he does a very good job, because you don't hate Captain Terrell.
Yeah.
Which is important, because you're not like, oh, thank God, Captain Terrell finally died. You're like, oh, man, that
it's really sad.
Sucks. Yeah.
It's really awful.
Like, he's trying to be noble to the very bitter end by killing himself rather than killing... Kirk. And there are some headcanon theories about how the screaming creature from when Terrell kills himself is somehow how the creature dislodged itself from Chekhov's brain. So by killing himself, he really freed Chekhov. But, you know, who's to say?
Yeah, I always, when as a kid, I was just like, you know, these little aliens that go into these little rats that go, rats, eels that go into the Chekhov's brain. It's an imperfect science. It's not going to work every time. And I just feel like, it just came out and that was it.
Yeah, he tilted his head the wrong way. So they go down to the planet's surface, inside the planet's surface, to the caverns, because they're like, you know, hey, they have transporter coordinates on this Klingon console that we got from the first movie. And it's like, hey, so let's go down there. And it's like, you know, suppose they went nowhere. Well, it's your big chance to get away from it all. I like that exchange.
Me too.
And they go down on the disco pads to the cavern. And before they do that, they have the conversation about, you know, hours may seem like days, blah, blah, blah. And so it's like the worst code you've ever heard in your entire life. But it works on Khan's superior intellect. And they beam down to the cavern. They have a fight with the scientists who are like, we're scientists, blah. And then they're like, so what? And we have, like Dan said, the worst fight between Kirk.
So
it's pretty clunky.
Yeah. It's just like, pow, bang, zam. it is not at all clear how this was an effective battle between two people. And they, no, it's like, you know, I'm looking for Dr. Carol Marcus. I'm looking for Dr. Marcus. And it's like, I'm Dr. Marcus. And it's like, well, whoops, wrong one. And there's the other guy. And then, you know, they have their exchange. But it's very quickly overturned by the fact that Paul Winfield is secretly mind-controlled. And he's got a wrist communicator from the first movie on instead of the flip-over communicator that you've seen the rest of the film. But so he's talking to Khan. He's like, Your Excellency, have you heard the whole thing? And he's like, yes. So, you know, kill people and stuff. And unfortunately, one of the scientists jumps and gets shot because Paul Winfield has an itchy trigger finger. So goodbye, extra scientist. We didn't really need to know anything about. You're gone. And then it's like, you know, it's really hard to kill Admiral Kirk. I just, you know, I don't know about that. You know, you got the other stuff, you know, you got the coordinates for that. So maybe we don't need to do it. And it's like, no, really kill him. Please do it now. And Paul Winfield's like, I don't know. It's really hard. I'm just gonna shoot myself. And then he dies and it's sad. And then Chekhov falls and doubles over and stuff, and the thing crawls out, and they shoot it. And then Khan's like, oh, well, let's just beam up the thing, like Terrell said to do before he died. And they do, and it's gone. And then everyone else in the tunnel is sad. And Kirk is like, hey, you've, like a poor marksman, you keep missing the target. You're going to have to come down here, Khan. You know, and that doesn't really, like, win over Khan in terms of like arguments about things that he should do. So he's like, no can do, buddy. Day planner is full. Franklin Covey is all set. And I'm not going to do that. I'm going to leave you like you left me, like you left her, buried alive. Khan! Yeah.
Which is a nice scene right up until the shout. I mean, the shout is weird. It's really, really weird. And the echoey, you know, subsequent shot of the moon surface. It's weird. And it's fine. It's iconic. But it's all fine. But here's the thing that not a lot of people talk about. That Khan, that in anger or whatever, is Kirk acting at that moment? You know what I mean? Because is he really afraid for his life and everything? Or because he's been sending out these coded messages to Spock and he knows in 2 hours they're going to have main power back up and probably be able to beam him out. Is he kind of just playing? You know what I'm thinking at here?
I think he's improvising. I think that if Khan had beamed him up, he would come up with another plan. But at the same time, I think he still has the other plan in his mind, which is why he is so cocky. So I think it could be read either of those two ways. Like, I don't think he is at all like, oh, I'm really disappointed Khan didn't beam me up. I think that he just would have done either of those two things.
Yeah. Yeah. It works either way.
But anyway, It is an effective scene, in my opinion, despite its cheeseballiness, which I feel like most of its cheeseballiness is due to the fact that it happened in this film, and the cultural awareness of this film is what makes it cheesy. I think that in isolation, if you just showed this to someone who hadn't seen any other piece of pop culture after 1982, they'd be like, wow, that was cool. But the fact that we know that Khan is like such a big deal, that's what helps contribute to it being like so absurd. But they have Khan beam up the thing, and then they have them all down there in the tunnel, and it's like, hey, I'm hungry. And then they're like, well, how can you think about food like in a time like this? This is, you know, like totes not what it's about, bro. But they're like, nope, we're gonna go to the thing and do the stuff. And then he talks to Carol for a bit in private, and it's like, you know, I wanted him in my world and blah blah blah, like sun thing, which we had figured out from like 40 minutes ago. And it's fine.
It wasn't for a bit. They talked for a long time in a single, like, long take, with neither of them moving at all, and no music, no camera movement, no nothing. And I'm just wondering, yeah, Dan was probably asleep at that point, or just checking up on his Twitter.
No,
and everything.
There.
Like
I was trying to figure it out. I was still kind of reeling from the whole the shout that, again, since I'm a horrible person and I saw all of these backwards, while I recognized the frame when the frame appeared on the screen, it happened earlier in the movie than I'd expected it, because, you know, the other one's later in the movie.
But, I mean, even for me, that scene, the subsequent scene of them, he and Marcus talking, it does drag on even for me. And I find myself going, oh, my gosh, am I awake? Am I asleep? What's going on here?
Well, I'm sure just like me, as soon as you get onto the next scene where they go visit the giant matte painting, you completely forget about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, they're several of my paintings, because we have the one with the waterfall, we have the one with the light that's off to the side of the cavern where you can't see the light sources, we have the other one the reverse shot of that. So there's matte paintings aplenty, a cornucopia of matte paintings, and so they talk about stuff and things and
talk about the Kobayashi Maru.
Yeah, and Savik's like,
in case you forgot about it, just bringing that
back
up.
I want to know what your solution was to the no-win scenario. And McCoy's like, "You're cadet, you're looking at the only person to ever beat the no-win scenario." And it's just like, I changed the conditions of the test. You cheated. It's like, yeah, but LOL. Whatever, bro. I am a white guy who can do whatever I want. Like, LOL. That is the Kirk modus operandi. And everyone else laughs along. Funny story. And then they all get beamed back up to the Enterprise because Kirk doesn't like to lose. And
crunch.
No.
And he crunches that apple. Come on. You know, that's a good scene.
Yeah. And you know, like no uncoded transmission on a monitored channel or whatever it is. And so that's why they said hours may seem like days. LOL. Wasn't that funny? And so they have their little exchange there where they get back on board the ship. Turbolifts aren't operative below C deck. They go back up to the bridge and they're going to get on their way. And Khan's all like, where's the Enterprise? Why can't I blow up stuff? I'm really frustrated right now. And they have the tactical view about the moon. And they're like, hey, we can spin around the other side of this thing faster than the other guys. And back on the Enterprise, they're like, this is not going to work out well for us. So let's go over to this dust cloud, which we've seen in wide shots, which is done in a salt tank kind of thing. And we'll go hang out over there. And Savik's like, no, our shields and our tactical views and our scanners will be useless. And Spock says, sauce for the goose. And I love that because it is not very Vulcan. It is kind of hilarious.
It does sound like more of a McCoy line.
Yes.
You gotta have sauce in your goose or whatever.
Yeah, because that's how you even your odds. You sauce your goose. It's what they say in statistics classes, I guess. But they go ahead and they do their goose saucing, and they get into the nebula, and Khan's ship's slowing down because the guy's like, hey, let's not do that. And Khan's like, okay, fine. And then Kirk's like, well, I'm going to troll him now. Put me on the MRA trolling frequency. And so he's like, hey, hey guys, I'm still alive. So come after me, bro.
And I'm laughing at the superior intellect.
Yes. And this is where Khan is not holding it all together.
We tried it once your way, Khan. He's like really laying it on thick.
It is so thick.
And it works. It works.
Yeah. I mean, well, we've clearly established by this point in the film that Khan is not necessarily motivated by his superior intellect.
I was going to say, where is the superior intellect in this movie?
Well, I mean, he has superior, like, plotting intellect, but in terms of, like, jerky moves, like, he's not that good at it. He's just always falls back to, well, how can I be the jerkiest? And so he tries to be jerky and go after them. And he fires...
The slow-speed spaceship chase over to the nebula?
Well, you know, Dan, they're moving pretty quick. It's just because you're so far away that they look slow.
Oh, is that what
it is? And I would say also say that both ships are really hobbled.
Well, yeah, no, that's the point. They are hobbled. They're moving slowly, but it's just kind of funny that it's just like a nice slow speed chase.
Yeah, it's like two James Caans in Misery chasing one another.
What a horrible mental image.
Well, that's the only way I can get through to you, Dan. So they go through into the nebula, and then, you know, the whole ship shudders for no apparent reason, really. And they have the screen go all staticky and stuff, and then everyone forgets that they have windows on board. And so they spend the rest of the film trying to figure out how they can see the other ship. It's a lot of fun, really.
Well, I think that's what's kind of neat. It goes from a Horatio Hornblower, like, you know, seafaring odyssey to a submarine picture at that point where nobody can see anything and they're all just doing their best guess type stuff. But it would have had been a nice cutaway to Kirk saying, could somebody just go to a window and see if you can see anything? I mean, we've had a lot of establishing shots of the Enterprise. There are windows here. Just have a few people looking out and have them on the con and see if we can see anything out here. But the way they play it out with the static and the view screen and just catching glimpses of where each other is, it's good stuff. It's good drama.
Yes. And, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, you know, you got like your pros and your cons. And
cons, really.
Yeah, you gotta...
Multiple James Caans and...
Cons to the left of me, cons to the right of me, falling in thunder. So you gotta work with what you got here with these. And it's kind of amazing how they managed to have these shots with the light strobing over the stuff and they can't see out of the things. It's like, maybe that could have been a plot point, like you're saying. Like, they could have had some guy run over and be like, nope, can't see anything. It's pea soup. But they don't do that. They just have static, which is not as effective, I feel. But they go through the process of trying to find one another and shooting at one another and doing the submarine movie. And they finally have that confrontation where Spock explains to Kirk that Khan demonstrates a pattern, you know, of two-dimensional thinking. Let's, like, you know, be smarter than that. And Kirk finally cottons on to this. It takes him a second where he's like, oh, Spock means we should move down or up. And so he does that. And that's how they finally get the leg up on Khan and blow the bejesus out of his ship. And Khan is all like, no, bruh. No, I got this. I got this, bruh. I'm going to blow up all y'alls. And he starts playing with the little metal depression button pad thing, which has the metal collar things which slide down and do the thing, which is impressive.
I love that.
I really do visually enjoy that. It makes no sense.
No. I mean, it's like, but it's something tactile. It's something heavy. It's impressive. It reminds me of the Nostromo self-destruct sequence from Alien. Ripley has to do all those undo all those bolts and then turn these levers. And I love that instruction. The instructions printed on the underside of the lid in probably Helvetica, and it's just like this giant wad of text that there's no way anybody could read. It's something cool when you have your characters like player, you know, have to move stuff around and spin, and it's something heavy and they can touch, as opposed to which is what you know happens in almost all sci-fi movies. They type on a keypad or keyboard and beep, boop, 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 and then some stupid graphic shows them something. I like that. I like that bit.
Well, see, the thing is, if you have the hardware feature, you can't really upgrade the software later and use it for something else, which I was genuinely confused, like, why there was a hardware panel in this, because I thought it was for, like, a self-destruct sequence, but then it was for the Genesis thing. I'm like, wait, well, how is that? How did it come out of the thing there? Like, when did they have time to install that?
No, but that was the little box they beamed up. If you're watching the cavern sequence, there is the big torpedo thing.
Right, and maybe it was just from not having seen it before, but it looked like it was part of the room. Like it wasn't just a box sitting there.
Yeah, they don't make it very clear. I mean, you see earlier in the film what young Dr. Marcus, the Kirk's boy, when he's adding data to the thing, you see that implement that he's actually working with the concentric circles and everything. But it's not made very clear that it's a two-part system, and there's like a control panel and there's a torpedo. So no, I hear you.
It doesn't have like a label printed on it that says Genesis device, but it's on repeated viewings, which I'm sure you are on your way to doing.
Yeah, as soon as we're done, Dan's gonna
go watch it again.
First, he's gonna check out the Vulcan subtitles on YouTube, and then he's gonna, oh yeah, that's what they said. That makes perfect sense. Now I love this movie.
But so the thing is, Khan is like his face is looking a little like a horde of meatloaf. Like it is not a good look for him.
He's basically halfway to The Walking Dead.
Yeah, for 1982 makeup effects, that was pretty good, by the way. If anyone's wondering if that was a good, like, burned face look. Like
It looks good now. What's the problem?
Yeah, no, but it's impressive that they were able to pull that off. Think about, like, makeup in 1982, like, what that looked like. If you were watching other films, and it's like, oh, burned faces, good job, Star Trek, you did it. And so they have, you know, his horde of meatloaf side of his face, and he's all coddled up next to his metal circle thing, and he pushes the stuff, and he's like, from hell's heart, I stab at thee, for hate's sake, I spit my last breath at thee. And it's great stuff. I love it.
Hang on. How often do you say that? And it's completely committed to memory, right? You didn't, like, look at that on a card?
I say it a lot, and
me too.
Yeah,
I do.
Okay, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Just gotta check sometimes.
Virtual high five, Todd.
Yeah.
So the thing is that he's not happy, and he's setting off the thing.
Well, I have two quick notes before that. One, when the big giant piece of Reliant bridge lands on his buddy, and he actually picks it up and throws it off, which is
shocking.
It's not exactly the most convincing effect, but it's the only time in the entire movie that you actually see his physical feet, you know, his strength, because that's something they played up a big time in Space Seed, the original series episode.
He picked up Chekhov by his spacesuit handle.
That's true. But I thought that was a nice little thing. Okay, so Joaquin is dying in his arms, and he cradles him, and it's a nice little touch, a nice little moment. And he cradles him, he puts his head in him, and he goes, I shall avenge you. It's like, whoa, hold on, Khan. How's this revenge thing working out so far?
Exactly.
Stop making these kind of promises.
Exactly, Todd. That is one of my favorite things, is that his idea of revenge is so out of whack that he can't deliver on any of these revenge promises. And all he knows how to do is avenge people. So
he's writing checks the Reliant can't cash at this point. It's not going to work.
Oh, yeah. The Bank of Vengeance can't cash these. But so they he's setting off the thing, and then they're like, oh, hey, there's a power wave. Let's throw that up on our monitor back there. And hey, look, circles. And David, who is on the bridge with his, like, I don't know, golf club course
the,
look.
The sweater. You're talking about the sweater.
The sweater.
And Meyer talks about that in the book as one of his regrets of the way he had that sweater draped over his shoulders. It's like, yeah, that was a mistake.
That was so right. Dumb.
It does, is bad. It's bad.
It is like, of all the things that are dated or weird about this film, it's like sweater. Yeah. Number one. You're there. And so anyway, they're like, yeah, so there are circles and they're on a buildup to detonation. Oh, no, let's beam over there. No, you can't. And it's like, well, of course you can't, because that's that kind of movie, I guess. And that's contrived. But they say these things, and then Spock's like, hey, I got an idea. I'm going to go down to the radiation room and do the thing. And so he leaves. And then nobody else pays attention to that.
Yeah, okay. So this is one of my quibbles of the movie. And I admire so much about this. But I don't think they did a good enough job setting up why Spock had to actually go down there and do what he had to do. I you know, there's the Scotty says, I have to take the mains offline for some reason. And then you see him kind of faint because of the radiation leakage or whatever. They point to that room, which has the little, you know, like cylinder in the middle with the cap on it. There was nothing going on over the comm system that made me go, oh, yeah, Spock totally has to get down there and fix this thing. And only he can do it. And only he can sacrifice himself. Yeah, there's that line of, you know, as you know, I'm not human. What does McCoy say? Something like no human can survive in there. And
yeah. And Spock says, as you're so fond of pointing out, I'm not human.
This is only after, you know, many multiple viewings. I wish it was a little bit more clearly defined, where if we can only get in there and the circuits are fused, if we can rejigger, I don't know. It just seemed a little like haphazard of, yep, it's time to kill Spock and he's got to go in there and do that.
I don't mind the vagueness of what the specific task he had to accomplish was, because, you know, I'm not a warp drive mechanic, so I'm fine with that part of it. But it was weird that no one noticed he had left the bridge was gone for so long. That's the part that I thought was strange. But the fact that he had gone down there and he knew what he had to do, and that he, being someone who was so immersed in logic and the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few or the one, would do this, is not such a surprise or a shock to me.
No, not at all. But I wish it was a more clearly defined goal. Like, what? Why do we have to pop this lid off and do a thing? And then pop the lid back on. Like, I love the physicality of that. It's a cylinder, and he's got to put on gloves, and he's got to repair something. But that's only after you've seen the scene. And I don't know. I thought if it was a little bit more clearly defined, like, what the problem is, I think it would have... Here I am criticizing the third act of this movie, which just works really well. But that's my it's my little quibble with this otherwise really good scene.
I think it's a perfectly... acceptable quibble. I mean, it's not one that I am particularly like tripping over, but I could see it, like, because, you know, you don't really understand the mechanics of this. You just know that it is imperative that someone do something, and then it turns out to be him. And before this scene, McCoy confronts Spock and says, "You can't go in there," and. Like you said, she'll find a point here. I'm a human. And then they do the mind meld, and he says, "Remember," and then drops him. And this is because Leonard Nimoy had wanted to die as Spock, because he was like, this is really killing my career, and I want to do other stuff. And then he had so much fun making this that he was like, hey, maybe don't kill me. So they had this idea where they would deposit his brain inside of McCoy.
Yeah, those were all pickups. That had Nicholas Meyer was totally against this idea. They shot it without the little hand remember bit, the little mind meld thing. And like you said, and Paramount, the buzz was really building about this picture when they were cutting it together. And like they thought they may have a hit on their hands, and they got really nervous that they just killed off one of the main characters, and this was their like insurance policy. And Meyer was just absolutely, you know, floored. This is what we wrote. This is what we did. This is Spock dying. We are not going to leave this little bit of hope for franchise reasons. This is not what I had signed up for. So he refused to participate in those pickups. And then that includes the shots of the torpedo, you know, his coffin on the on the surface of that planet, on the Genesis planet. Yeah, so it's kind of funny, and that was all pickup stuff, or that those little inserts were pickup. It's a great sci-fi conceit, you know. It's like little remember thing, and you know, because if you're watching it for the first time and you don't know anything about Star Trek or mind melds or anything, you're just like, what the heck was that? And you know, moving on. And then the final payoff doesn't happen until, you know, whatever, a couple years later when you see Star Trek 3, and that's the big deal. So yeah, it's clever.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where it's like, as a fan, it doesn't bother me. And I understand Nicholas Meyer's objections at the time he was making it. But it's actually a good thing that he was overridden and they wound up doing this, because could you imagine if they hadn't?
It's better for the franchise. It absolutely is better for the franchise. And it's done in a vague enough way that it does not, stop the movie to a halt, where he sits down and he does this long mind meld thing, my mind to your mind, or, you know, no chance.
Your thoughts to my thoughts.
Exactly. Yeah, all that. Yeah. Sorry about that. I thought I was.
Oh, no,
fan.
No. I mean, that's the next thing he says. It's all part of the thing.
Sorry, Dan. But
Dan still on the line?
I'm still here listening. I'm trying to put this all together in context. But is the
when he does that little remember thing? Did that throw you off? Did that was like?
I didn't entirely get what it was for. I mean, now that you've said it, sure, it makes sense, because I did realize we talked about that in the other episode. But it does seem slightly outside the character of this world, sort of based on science, and sort of especially him being a logical character, to use that as sort of like a backdoor way to make sure, like, this is our insurance policy. While that's cool thing to do in the movie, and it makes sense in the, you know, the context that we have all of these movies now, it doesn't really seem to line up with the logic of the universe in this particular movie. Yeah. But it doesn't bother me, really.
Yeah,
well, as long as Dan's okay with it,
as long as I approve. Yeah, we're good.
Yeah. And so Spock goes in and he takes off the cap on the air jet and moves the things and the stuff, and then closes the thing. And then they get warp speed and they get out of there, and ta-da, dissolves between different paintings. And then they're like, hey, so that nebula turned into a planet. That's cool. And they get away, and then Kirk realizes that someone has been missing from the bridge for like 20 minutes. And he goes down because McCoy's like, hey, Jim, you better get down here.
That's like the Star Trek trope, you know? It's something that you could probably, you know, communications over the comm. Like, yeah, you can tell me the whole story over the comm. You don't have to get down here. You better get down here. This is the best use of that trope. It is, and the McCoy's delivery of that line, Jim, you better get out.
With the shot of the empty chair.
Holy crap, that empty chair shot.
Yeah, and so then Kirk goes down there, and we have the shot with Spock where he's stumbling back up, and he tries to fix his uniform, tries to straighten out the uniform.
I love that detail.
Yeah,
it's,
I mean,
so nice.
They put so much effort into this, and he stumbles over to the glass wall where Kirk is, and they try to talk through the glass wall one-to-one about what has occurred. And, you know, he never faced the Kobayashi Maru until now. What do you think of my results? And it is both entertaining and heartbreaking at the same time, because you have him trying to make this sort of joke, but it is also an acknowledgement of his own mortality. Like he is also dying because of his solution to the no win scenario. They have the exchange through the glass for the rest of the scene, where he says, you know, I have been and always shall be your friend. And, you know, the live long and prosper, and the Vulcan hand salute, as it is known, with the, I mean, this even adopted as an emoji thing that I send to Dan sometimes when I want to bother him.
But think about the blocking, not, you know, the performances and everything, but that blocking of that. It's basically all played in that two shot of mainly looking at Spock, but you get enough of Shatner's side of his face that they're both acting. It's not Nimoy's shot. It's both of their shots. You see them looking at each other and how they start standing, and then they drift downward because he goes to his knees, and then they drift downward even further. Physically separated, they can't touch each other. It's really, really sharp stuff.
Dan, what are your objections?
I have no objections, and you guys pointed out the part where Spock like sort of like straightens his uniform and wanders over there. But there's even that moment like when he gets over there that like you can tell like he's gone blind because he kind of like walks into the glass, and that's one of those moments where I was like, whoa, that's acting and clearly illustrating exactly the extent of what's going on here, because you didn't expect it. You expect him to sort of walk over and just have the conversation, but it certainly caught me off guard when he bumped into it, and then, you know, they started their conversation, because he's clearly trying to maintain his dignity, and he is severely screwed up.
Yeah, and you know, he's dignified to the last when they have this exchange. You know, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few, or the one, and it's all of the things that they had been saying to one another through the course of the film played out in his death scene. And it is dramatic. It has an air of inevitability in that neither of them can fix this, but it still allows them the space in which to discuss his death. It is unusual in terms of like film deaths, because usually it's like something that's fast and quick and happens, you know, and it's done. And in this, it's like, this is not fast and it's not quick, and they can discuss every detail of how this relates to the rest of the film you just saw. So it is memorable, at least in terms of death sequences in a film. And I find it somewhat noteworthy for that, at least in terms of other films of the era and films nowadays. I mean, most of the time you just see somebody get whacked off the screen, and that's it. And that's the memorable moment. They might say something right before some untimely demise, but like there are no like protracted, like I'm going to die, like mm-hmm. this is the end, mm-hmm. like scenes these days like this. So I do feel like this is important. And I know that they tried to revisit this with the Star Trek Into Darkness version of this, where Kirk is the one who is inside of the reactor and he's talking to Spock. I don't find that as effective, but I had seen this first, but perhaps having seen this has skewed my opinion of that other scene. So that is entirely possible. I'd need some sort of weird sample group of people who hadn't seen this movie, who saw the other one first. So Dan,
Dan, wake up, Dan.
What is your opinion of this versus perhaps the other scene?
They're both good.
They're both decent. No, they're both great. You love them.
They're both effective scenes. They both clearly illustrate that the person was willing to sacrifice their life to save the rest of the crew. I think in Into Darkness it was again because being the reboot, we have two movies with these characters and less so than these characters who are in the movie and show together. It sort of seemed like one of the few moments where we actually got an illustration of the relationship that was growing between Spock and Kirk in Into Darkness versus in this one, you felt like, you know, there was clearly a longer relationship that they were losing at this point. It's a different kind of sadness from the sacrifice, but I think they both accomplished the same goal.
Good answer, Dan.
Thank you.
I appreciate your diplomacy.
After saying I'm not going to say anything about Into Darkness for the whole entire podcast, now I'm going to say something about Into Darkness. I think one of the things that I think both scenes do very well is that it shows the chemistry between the actors. Like, it's right there on the screen. And obviously, Shatner and Nimoy working together for so long, they know each other's mannerisms. They can read each other, they play together very, very well. And one of JJ's great strengths is how he casts an ensemble and how those people will play work together and play off of each other. And by that point, Chris Pine and Zachary Quinto, you know, they definitely knew each other's moves. And I think that's one of their great scenes they have together, right up until the actual con screaming moment. Unfortunately, like Dan, I don't know, you saw the echo before the original, you know, voice happened. So I...
Is that a Nemesis reference?
Oh, God, no.
Okay.
Never would I. Okay. Any Nemesis references were purely accidental.
Well, echo over the voice. Anyway.
Oh, God, cut that out then. Jeez, I don't want anybody to get the wrong impression. Oh,
I'm going to frame it. The thing is, I don't have like a really super strong opinion. I just wanted to hear both of you talk about it, and I'm so happy right now. So they have this death scene, and it is a notable death scene. We move on to the funeral scene of Spock being placed inside of this torpedo and being issued these funeral rites. Yeah, burial at sea. He's fired out of the torpedo while Scotty is playing the bagpipes with Amazing Grace, which is apparently a request of Gene Roddenberry. It is kind of peculiar in that there is not a lot of like super amazing religious stuff happening in Star Trek. So Amazing Grace, interesting choice, but that is what happens.
It was some good bagpipery.
Yes, but it wasn't James Doohan. And so the line goes off to the side and then arcs back down, and then we're in, I don't remember, it was like Santa Barbara something conservatory thing or something. I don't even remember.
Botanical Gardens in San Francisco, actually.
Oh, okay, that's the one. And so they're in the Botanical Gardens, and there is the tube. And they would go on to use this photon torpedo tube for like literally everything ever. So it was a good choice. And then we get the sensation that it has soft landed somewhere, and maybe this coffin might hold some mysteries or some more information or something or things and stuff.
Myers got a great story about the funeral scene where he had scripted for Savick to be tearing up. And apparently on set, Shatner said, no, you can't have a Vulcan cry. That's impossible. That's not going to work. And Meyer, who was never a fan of the show, who never had seen the show when he was first introduced to the concept of even directing a Star Trek movie, he said, wait, that's the one with the guy with the pointy ears, right? He had no particular reverence for these characters. He just wanted to tell a really good story. So when Shatner goes, you can't have a Vulcan cry, he responded with, that's even more reason why I want her to cry. It's more significant. It's more impactful. I don't know. I just think that's funny, you know, with all these franchise rules and canon and all this stuff. I thought that was really cool to have somebody come in and be dispassionate about this stuff. And canon comes from ideas and taking things and, you know, let's not be so scientific about this stuff. If you're always afraid to create new canon, you're just going to be stuck in a rut. And I thought that was really interesting. It was a cool choice to have a guy who didn't love Star Trek to make a Star Trek film, which is why I think JJ was actually a really interesting choice. He respected to do the reboot. He respected Star Trek, but he was not a super fan. You know, his producers and his screenwriters definitely were, but he could take it. Like Meyer, have a little bit more of a dispassionate view and really concentrate on the drama, concentrate on the characters, and, you know, throw everybody a bone every once in a while. Oh, Spock does a little eyebrow, you know, shift or something like that. You know, all that stuff, which didn't really mean much to him. He was just more concerned about storytelling and character.
I agree to a point. Like, Stuart Baird is an example where I think that falls down, where somebody who didn't know or care about Star Trek, like, undermined the film he was making by not knowing and not caring. And I think that it was Nicholas Meyer's lack of familiarity but guidance through, like, working with Harv Bennett and working with the other people around him that he created a sense of what was important to him for telling the story that ended up working in such a fundamental way that we keep revisiting this. Like, it's like the Goldfinger of Star Trek movies.
Yeah.
But it is not always a recipe for success to just have somebody who doesn't know what they're doing. No.
Absolutely.
In charge. Defend yourself, Dan.
I got nothing. Third base.
Who's on first?
I like JJ's movies.
Okay. That's fine. You're allowed to be on the podcast tomorrow and the next day.
Tomorrow?
And the day
what
after.
Are we doing tomorrow?
Oh, jeez.
The same thing we do every night, Dan. Try to take over the world.
That's good. That was good there.
Yeah. They fire him off and he has a soft landing and then it's like, oh, you know, I'm in my quarters now and I'm all sulky and I'm drinking things. And then David walks in and it's like, you know, I'm proud to have you as a father. And it's a nice moment. It's not super effective because we had seen him with a sweater draped over his shoulders before. So we have that. And they're like, yay, we're together. And then we have the captain's log. You know, we're going to go pick up the crew of the Reliant from City Alpha 5. And isn't that nice? And they're gonna peel off, and it's like I feel young again, as Dan objected to earlier. And we close out with the opening of Star Trek. That, you know, this is, you know, the mission to boldly go where no one has gone before. And it's delivered by a husky Leonard Nimoy voice because he is dead. And we get the lens that Dan hates, and we go through the stars that Dan hates and the planets that Dan hates, and we get to the credits that Dan hates. care to revise any of that, Dan?
I don't hate anything. I just no. I...
The way you grumbled really sold that.
I don't hate it. I just thought it was peculiar.
Okay. Well, it's nice. I like it. I like the way the movie ends, actually. Now, Todd, do you like the way the movie ends?
Yeah, I thought having Nimoy, you know, read those iconic lines as opposed to Shatner, and, you know, especially after all we just went through watching him die, you know, it's a nice moment. And I love the disorientation of that goofy lens where you're just kind of panning and tilting around and in that star field. I thought that was pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. Ta-da. We finished the movie, Dan.
Yay.
You made it to the end of a Star Trek film.
Could I be back on when we cover a movie that Dan likes?
I'm not sure that's physically possible.
Oh, okay, let me start that with over. Dan, Do you like movies?
I love movies. Yes, I
like a movie.
Many movies. many movies. Mostly, you like mostly the idea not, of mostly movies? Not, mostly not movies that involve space.
Wait, hold on. Challenge accepted. There are no movies that have a space component that you might enjoy.
No, I enjoy them. My favorite movies are not movies that involve space. This is the dynamic on this show.
Okay.
It is an amazing dynamic.
Somehow it has worked for 88 episodes.
It's really, you know, a push and pull that occurs between us. It is the tension that really draws in listeners for some reason.
I make Joe watch a movie about motorcycles and nothingness, and then he makes me watch this movie.
Yeah, I still haven't listened to that yet.
Don't watch Torque, please.
Oh, I'm not going to watch it. It's like the Flophouse. I'm not going to watch the movie first.
But then you'll miss all of the fun visual style. It's very much a style over substance movie.
I remember the commercials for Torque. I remember this wonderful CG shot of a motorcycle jumping onto a moving train.
You are correct, yes.
Okay, yeah, I remember the ads for that, yeah. And going, wow, that CG
sure is.
Them's made of computer graphics.
It's kind of crazy stuff those visual effects places down in Los Angeles do.
Mm. Okay.
Defend yourself, Dan.
Not to peel back the curtain too much. The other movie that the three of us might talk about, do you like that movie? Do you know what I'm talking about? I'm being purposefully coy?
What now?
Am I being over coy? Oh, I'm being over coy.
Coy is a kind of fish, Dan.
Oh, boy. Anyway.
A fish called...
I'm also really good at like crapping all over movies too. So
Dan, you have failed.
But I wasn't going to give you the satisfaction. I knew where you were going.
But you've already done Watchmen, so I'm not gonna. No, I'm kidding.
We haven't done Watchmen.
No, we haven't.
You didn't. I
worked on it, so I can't talk about it.
Yeah. Well,
that's why we can't have you on to talk about The Force Awakens because you worked on it.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll just.
You can just sit
quiet.
There silently and just make grumbly noises and sighs as we talk about it.
Both of you will say, "Todd, defend yourself." What happened that day, Todd?
So in summation, Todd likes this movie, and even though he has betrayed everyone and everything that he loves because he loves Star Wars, he still likes the Star Trek movie. So that's nice. I like that.
What did you guys? Can I ask you, what did you guys think of the visual effects of this movie? We talked about the big foam rubber ear, and we talked about the other things. But what about the space sequences, the nebula, and the Enterprise itself? What did you guys think of that stuff? Because it's an interesting time in ILM's history. Because that was like the first time they were working on like non Lucasfilm shows, and they were split between I think it was ET and Poltergeist at the time. Between Empire and Jedi. I don't know. What did you guys think of that?
I loved everything they did, except for the strobe light God Ray Enterprise scene when they're inside the nebula. You know the one I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, I thought that was super cheese balls. But the rest of it, I loved. Dan.
See, I just got to wait for you to cue me now. Yeah, I thought it was all really, really well done. And it was all very believable. And, you know, it's probably more just the time and the style. The models were more lit than they would be today. They would typically go for a more dramatic lighting look. But the style at the time was a little bit flatter and a little easier to see everything. But I thought it all looked great. I mean, the nebula. I don't know. Parts of it looked like they were fighting inside of a screensaver or something, but like it's a nebula. What do you want to do?
Ouch. I mean, it was a cool salt tank shot. A series of salt tank shots. I like the suspension of liquids and stuff to try and solve a problem. You know, they didn't have Houdini. They couldn't, you know, do it with all volumetric stuff.
Is that how you like to solve your problems, suspending things in liquids?
I like to shout Houdini, and then my problem's resolved.
I mean, I personally like the shot design You know, like Ralston and crew went from this to the space battle over Endor and Return of the Jedi. That was their next task. So, I mean, we're talking very different shot design where something like this, where it's a couple of ships and they're big and they're lumbering and they're slow and they're these big battleships. I mean, that's what Ralston and Meyer were going for. And they had to be super efficient with a small number of shots with a budget that was a fraction of something like Return of the Jedi. And Return of the Jedi was all about motion and dynamism and just crazy choreography, especially for that time. And you put like those sequences together, you know, and back to back, and you see very, very different styles, but still both, like, I thought really well executed.
That's kind of complicated. So that is a good point. I mean, I joked about them being like a slow speed car chase, but there is sort of a uniformity of speed between both of the ships, and it's both very slow and they're not doing a ton, which kind of makes it a little harder on the guys because you can scrutinize every little bit of it because it's just sort of sitting there for a while.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but... You know, like Todd said, these are capital ships. They're not supposed to like dogfight like the little tiny itty bitty fighters. So I like the scale of it. I think that like Star Wars with the Battle of Endor or something like that, which I love, by the way, it's one of my favorite space battles ever. Is that you get a sense of scale because you have a separation of different kinds of sizes of things. So you have your big capital ships and you have your tiny itty bitty fighters, and they're all like skirmishing around and doing stuff and moving around and blowing up, and things are cool. But you don't have that sense of scale in terms of like from the tiny to the large here. Yeah. You just have the two big ones.
Yep. I mean, it's different. It's two completely different challenges. And then you kind of just look at it in the context of what ILM and the rest of the industry was doing at the time. And it's just really fascinating. Same year as Blade Runner, totally different approach to shooting this stuff, and very different results, but both really good movies.
Yeah, and you have these ships, and Ralston inherited the original Enterprise design from Robert Abel and Associates, who did the first one, and he hated the Enterprise. The model itself was ungainly to mount and to try to do motion control camera moves with, and he didn't like the design of it, and he wanted nothing more than to blow it up. So he was so happy in Star Trek 3 when they blew it up, but then he was so unhappy in Star Trek 4 when they brought it back. So it's one of those things that amuses me when I watch this. It's just like, man, he must have really been peeved the whole time he was doing this, because it was such a pain in the butt to move the thing around, because apparently it was such an incredibly heavy and awkward model to work with.
What, ILM worked on 2, 3, 4,
and 6.
Skipped 5, yeah. 6, and then Generations.
And First Contact.
And First Contact. They were the lead house on First Contact, and I think...
They had nothing to do with Insurrection,
yeah,
and nothing to do with Nemesis, and then they were back for Star Trek 2009 and Into Darkness.
Yeah. And not Star Trek Beyond? Is that what it's called?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I haven't even looked. What is the situation with Beyond?
No Industrial Light and Magic.
Interesting.
Tell us why.
Defend yourself, Todd.
Sorry, you're cutting out. Cutting out here.
Who's taking Genesis from us, Todd?
We got who's Genesis? What?
So anyway, it was good having you on, Todd, and I really appreciate your insights and your enthusiasms. Because Dan has none, and it was very refreshing to have you fill in those gaps.
It's been my pleasure.
I'll smack you.
you can't smack me. I'm in another state.
I will track you down.
You won't track me down. Well, I mean, I will see you at your wedding, and then you can smack me then, but that seems like a really bad time to do that, but
no, it sounds
it's
like
up
a
to
perfect
you.
Time.
Yes, this is for Star Trek. Smack.
People will understand.
Right, just make sure you do it in front of everyone. And with like a white glove, just like smack me across the face.
I challenge you to a duel.
pistols at dawn.
No, too early.
Okay. Pistols at 11? Like, what is the deal? Waffle House? At a Waffle House?
No, they don't have
a
Waffle House. Is there a Waffle House?
Okay. Well, I'm sorry. We're not going to be able to do this duel to your standards, so I'm safe then. Ta-da.
Ta-da.
Space. The final frontier. These are the continuing voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Their ongoing mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life forms and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone.
Cue theme music.
Yes. We're done. We're, yay.
Where's theme music? Oh. Hey, what time is it?
It is 1:23 in the morning.
It is 12:23 in the morning. I can't believe it is so late. We are, boys and girls,
a mere 11 minutes away from the longest episode in incomparable history.
Darn.
And we are, I think we're a mere 3.5 minutes away from topping their Force Awakens episode.
I don't want to do that. We're done. we finished back when we finished.
Well, I'm going to paste in the chat and we'll do titles real fast and then we'll.
There's definitely places for Joe to cut if he wants to cut. Cut whatever you
want. No, he's going to put in clips from the movie and make it longer.
Oh, this is going to be so long. You have no idea.
I got to pause for just 1 second. I thought the kids were asleep. Hi. What are you doing?
We got two guests on the show.
I told my daughter, my 8-year-old, if you hear me talking out here to myself, I haven't gone crazy. I'm on a radio show. I'm in an internet radio show. Oh, by the way, what AM, what dial AM frequency do I need to tune to?
AM 970, the point.
The point, WPNT. Yeah. Come here and just say hi to Dan and Joe and say hi to the internet.
Hi.
Okay, that's great.
Hi.
It's time to go to bed.
Don't listen to your dad. Ruin everything. Wreck the furniture.
Okay, sorry about that, guys.
No worries.